tree-lined ridge spang in the middle of the God only knows. Ahead of them was a snowy forested valley. On its far side were eroded hills and brush-tangled breaks where not a single light shone. And, to finish things off, the day was fading toward dusk. "Another fine mess you've gotten us into, too," Jonesy thought. But he sensed no dismay on Mr. Gray's part. Mr. Gray stopped the snowmobile by releasing the throttle, and then simply sat there. "North," Mr. Gray said. Not to Jonesy. Pete answered out loud, his voice weary and slow. "How am I supposed to know? I can't even see where the sun's going down, for Christ's sake. One of my eyes is all fucked up, too." Mr. Gray turned Jonesy's head, and Jonesy saw that Pete's left eye was gone. The lid had been shoved up high, giving him a half-assed look of surprise. Growing out of the socket was a small jungle of virus. The longest strands hung down, tickling against Pete's stubbly cheek. More strands twined through his thinning hair in lush red-gold streaks. "You know."
"Maybe I do," Pete said. "And maybe I don't want to point you there."
"Why not?"
"'Cause I doubt if what you want is healthy for the rest of us, fuckface," Pete said.
And Jonesy felt an absurd sense of pride. Jonesy saw the growth in Pete's eye socket twitch. Pete screamed and clutched at his face. For a moment, brief but far too long, Jonesy fully imagined the reddish-gold tendrils reaching from that defunct eye into Pete's brain, where they spread like strong fingers clutching a gray sponge.
"Go on, Pete. Tell him," Jonesy cried. "For Christ's sake, tell him."
The virus grew still again. Pete's hand dropped from his face, which was now deathly pale where it wasn't reddish gold.
"Where are you, Jonesy?" he asked. "Is there room for two?"
The short answer, of course, was no. Jonesy didn't understand what had happened to him, but he knew that his continued survival, that last kernel of autonomy, somehow depended on him staying right where he was. If he so much as opened the door, he would be gone for good. Pete nodded.
"Didn't think so," he said, and then spoke to the other. "Just don't hurt me anymore, fella."
Mr. Gray only sat looking at Pete with Jonesy's eyes and making no promises. Pete sighed, then raised his scorched left hand and extended one finger. He closed his eyes and began to tick his finger back and forth, back and forth. And as he did it, Jonesy came close to understanding everything. What had that little girl's name been? Rinkenhauer, wasn't it? Yes. He couldn't remember the first name, but a clumsy handle like Rinkenhauer was hard to forget. She had also gone to Mary M. Snow, a.k.a. the Retard Academy, although by then Duddits had gone on to vocational. And Pete? Pete had always had a funny trick of remembering things, but after Duddits... The words came back to Jonesy as he crouched in his dirty little cell, looking out at the world which had been stolen from him. Only they weren't really words at all, only those open vowel sounds, so strangely beautiful.
"We are on it."
"Do you see the line, Pete?" Pete, his face full of dreamy, surprised wonder, had said, yes, he saw it. And he had been doing the thing with his finger then, that tick-tock thing, just as he was now. The finger stopped, the tip still trembling minutely like a dowsing rod at the edge of an aquifer. Then Pete pointed at the ridge, on a line slightly to starboard of the snowmobile's current heading.
"There,"
he said, and dropped his hand.
"Due north. Sight on that rock face, the one with the pine growing out of the middle. Do you see it?"
"Yes, I see it." Mr. Gray turned forward and put the snowmobile back into gear. Jonesy wondered fleetingly how much gas was left in the tank.
"Can I get off now?"
Meaning, of course, could he die now?
"No."
And they were off again, with Pete clinging weakly to Jonesy's coat. They skirted the rock face, climbed to the top of the highest hill beyond it, and here Mr. Gray paused again so his substitute flashlight could rehead them. Pete did so, and they continued on, now moving on a path that was a little bit west of true north. Daylight continued to fade. Once they heard helicopters, at least two, maybe as many as four, coming toward them. Mr. Gray bowled the snowmobile into a thick stand of underbrush, heedless of the branches that slapped at Jonesy's face, drawing blood from his cheeks and brow. Pete tumbled off the back again. Mr. Gray killed the cat's engine, then dragged Pete, who was moaning and semi-conscious, under the thickest growth of bushes. There they waited until the helicopters passed over. Jonesy felt Mr. Gray reach up to one of the crew and quickly scan him, perhaps cross-checking what the man knew with what Pete had been telling him. When the choppers had passed off to the southeast, apparently heading back to their base, Mr. Gray restarted the snowmobile, and they went on. It had begun to snow again. An hour later, they stopped on another rise, and Pete fell off the cat again, this time tumbling to the side. He raised his face, but most of his face was gone, buried under a beard of vegetation. He tried to speak aloud and couldn't. His mouth was stuffed, his tongue buried under a lush mat of virus.
"I can't, man. I can't no more, please. Let me be."
"Yes," Mr. Gray said. "I think you've served your purpose."
"Pete,"
Jonesy cried, then to Mr. Gray.
"No, no, no, don't."
Mr. Gray paid no attention, of course. For a moment, Jonesy saw silent understanding in Pete's remaining eye, and relief. For that moment, he was still able to touch Pete's mind, his boyhood friend, the one who always stood outside the gate at DJHS, one hand cupped over his mouth, hiding a cigarette that wasn't really there, the one who was going to be an astronaut and see the world entire from Earth orbit, one of the four who had helped save Duddits from the big boys. For one moment. Then he felt something leap from Mr. Gray's mind, and the stuff growing on Pete did not just twitch, but clenched. There was a tenebrous creaking sound as Pete's skull cracked in a dozen places. His face, what remained of it, pulled inward in a kind of yank, making him old at a stroke. Then he fell forward, and snow began to fleck the back of his parka. "You bastard." Mr. Gray, indifferent to Jonesy's curse and Jonesy's anger, made no reply. He faced forward again. The building wind dropped momentarily when he did, and a hole opened in the curtain of snow. About 5 miles northwest of their current position, Jonesy saw moving lights. Not flashlights, but headlights. Lots of them. Trucks moving in convoy along the turnpike. Trucks and nothing else, he supposed. This part of Maine belonged to the military now. "And they're all looking for you, asshole," he spat as the snowmobile began to roll again. The snow closed back around them, cutting off their momentary view of the trucks, but Jonesy knew that Mr. Gray would have no trouble finding the turnpike. Pete had gotten him this far, to a part of the quarantine zone where Jonesy supposed little trouble was expected. He was counting on Jonesy to take him the rest of the way, because Jonesy was different. For one thing, he was clear of the virus. The virus didn't like him for some reason. "You'll never get out of here," Jonesy said.
"I will," Mr. Gray said. "We always die, and we always live. We always lose, and we always win. Like it or not, Jonesy, we're the future."
"If that's true, it's the best reason I ever heard for living in the past," Jonesy replied. But from Mr. Gray, there was no answer. Mr. Gray, as an entity, a consciousness, was gone, merged back into the cloud. There was only enough of him left to run Jonesy's motor skills and keep the snowmobile pointed toward the turnpike. And Jonesy, carried helplessly forward on whatever mission this thing had, took slender comfort from two things. One was that Mr. Gray didn't know how to get at the last piece of him, the tiny part that existed in his memory of the Tracker Brothers' office. The other was that Mr. Gray didn't know about Duddits, about no bounce, no play. Jonesy intended to make sure Mr. Gray didn't find out. At least not yet. Chapter 13. At Goslin's. To Archie Perlmutter, high school valedictorian, speech topic, the joys and the responsibilities of democracy, one-time Eagle Scout, faithful Presbyterian, and West Point grad, Goslin's country market no longer looked real. Now, spotlighted by enough candle power to illuminate a small city, it looked like a set in a movie. Not just any movie either, but the sort of James Cameron extravaganza where the catering costs alone would amount to enough to feed the people of Haiti for 2 years. Even the steadily increasing snow did not cut into the glare of the lights very much, or change the illusion that the whole works, from the crappy siding to the pair of tin wood stove stacks sticking crooked out of the roof to the single rusty gas pump out front, was simply set dressing. This would be Act One, Pearlie thought as he strode briskly along with his clipboard tucked under his arm. Archie Perlmutter had always felt he was a man of considerable artistic nature. Commercial, too. We fade in on an isolated country store. The old-timers are sitting around the wood stove. Not the little one in Goslin's office, but the big one in the store itself, while the snow pelts down outside. They're talking about lights in the sky, missing hunters, sightings of little gray men skulking around in the woods. The store owner, call him Old Man Rossiter, scoffs. "Oh, gosh and fishes, you're all just a bunch of old women," he says. And just then, the whole place is bathed in these brilliant lights. Think Close Encounters of the Third Kind. As a UFO settles down to the ground, bloodthirsty aliens come piling out, firing their death rays. It's like Independence Day, only here's the hook, in the woods. Beside him, Melrose, the cook's third, which was about as close as anyone got to an official rating on this little adventure, struggled to keep up. He was wearing sneakers on his feet instead of shoes or boots. Perlmutter had dragged him out of Spago's, which was what the men called the cook tent, and he kept slipping. Men and a few women passed everywhere around them, mostly at the double. Many were talking into lavalier mics or walkie-talkies. The sense that this was a movie set instead of a real place was enhanced by the trailers, the semis, the idling helicopters, the worsening weather had brought them all back in, and the endless conflicting roar of motors and generators. "Why does he want to see me?" Melrose asked again. Out of breath and whinier than ever. They were passing the paddock and corral to one side of Goslin's barn now. The old and dilapidated fence, it had been 10 years or more since there'd been an actual horse in the corral or exercised in the paddock, had been reinforced by alternating strands of barbed wire and smooth wire. There was an electrical charge running through the smooth wire, probably not lethal, but high enough to lay you out on the ground convulsing, and the charge could be jacked up to lethal levels if the natives became restless. Behind this wire, watching them, were 20 or 30 men, Old Man Goslin among them. In the James Cameron version, Goslin would be played by some craggy old-timer like Bruce Dern. Earlier, the men behind the wire would have called out, issuing threats and angry demands, but since they'd seen what happened to that banker from Massachusetts who tried to run, their peckers had wilted considerably, poor fellows. Seeing someone shot in the head took a lot of the fuck you out of a man. And then there was the fact that all the ops guys were now wearing nose and mouth masks. That had to take whatever fuck you was left. "Boss?" Almost whining had given way to actual whining. The sight of American citizens standing behind barbed wire had apparently added to Melrose's unease. "Boss, come on! Why does the big boy want to see me? Big boy shouldn't know a cook's third even exists." "I don't know," Pearlie replied. It was the truth. Up ahead, standing at the head of what had been dubbed Eggbeater Alley, was Owen Underhill and some guy from the motor pool. The motor pool guy was almost shouting into Underhill's ear in order to make himself heard over the racket of the idling helicopters. Surely, Perlmutter thought, they'd shut the choppers down soon. Nothing was going to fly in this shit, an early season blizzard that Kurtz called our gift from God. When he said stuff like that, you couldn't tell if Kurtz really meant it or was just being ironic. He always sounded like he meant it. But then sometimes he would laugh, the kind of laugh that made Archie Perlmutter nervous. In the movie, Kurtz would be played by James Woods, or maybe Christopher Walken. Neither one of them looked like Kurtz, but had George C. Scott looked like Patton? Case closed. Perlmutter abruptly detoured toward Underhill. Melrose tried to follow and went on his ass, cursing. Perlmutter tapped Underhill on his shoulder. then hoped his mask would at least partially conceal his expression of surprise when the other man turned. Owen Underhill looked as if he had aged 10 years since stepping off the Millinocket School Department bus. Leaning forward, Pearlie shouted over the wind, "Kurtz in 15! Don't forget!" Underhill gave him an impatient wave to say he wouldn't, and turned back to the motor pool guy. Perlmutter had him placed now. Brodsky, his name was. The men called him Dog. Kurtz's command post, a humongous Winnebago, if this were a movie set it would be the star's home away from home, or perhaps Jimmy Cameron's, was just ahead. Pearlie picked up the pace, facing boldly forward into the flick, flick, flick of the snow. Melrose scurried to catch up, brushing snow off his coverall. "Come on, Skipper," he pleaded. "Don't you have any idea?" "No," Perlmutter said. He had no clue as to why Kurtz would want to see a cook's third, with everything up and running and in high gear. But, he thought, both of them knew it couldn't be anything good. Owen turned Emil Brodsky's head, placed the bulb of his mask against the man's ear, and said, "Tell me again. Not all of it, just about the part you called the mindfuck." Brodsky didn't argue, but took 10 seconds or so to arrange his thoughts. Owen gave it to him. There was his appointment with Kurtz, and debriefing after that, plenty of crew, reams of paperwork, and God alone knew what gruesome tasks to follow, but he sensed this was important. Whether or not he would tell Kurtz remained to be seen. At last, Brodsky turned Owen's head, placed the bulb of his own mask against Owen's ear, and began to talk. The story was a little more detailed this time, but essentially the same. He had been walking across the field next to the store, talking to Cambry beside him, and to an approaching fuel supply convoy at the same time, when all at once he felt as if his mind had been hijacked. He had been in a cluttery old shed with someone he couldn't quite see. The man wanted to get a snowmobile going and couldn't. He needed the dog to tell him what was wrong with it. "I asked him to open the cowling," Brodsky shouted into Owen's ear. "He did, and then it seemed like I was looking through his eyes, but with my mind, do you see?" Owen nodded. "I could see right away what was wrong. Someone had taken the plugs out. So I told the guy to look around, which he did, which we both did. And there they were, in a jar of gasoline on the table. My dad used to do the same thing with the plugs from his lawn boy and his rototiller when the cold weather came." Brodsky paused, clearly embarrassed either by what he was saying or how he imagined it must sound. Owen, who was fascinated, gestured for him to go on. "There ain't much more. I told him to fish him out, dry him off, and pop him in. It was like a billion times I've helped some guy work on something, except I wasn't there. I was here. None of it was happening." Owen said, "What next?" Bellowing to be heard over the engines, but the two of them still as private as a priest and his customer in a church confessional. "Started up first crank. I told him to check the gas while he was at it, and there was a full tank. He said thanks." Brodsky shook his head wonderingly. "And I said, 'No problem, boss.' Then I kind of thumped back into my own head and I was just walking along. You think I'm crazy?" "No, but I want you to keep this to yourself for the time being." Under his mask, Brodsky's lips spread in a grin. "Oh, man, no problem there either. I just, well, we're supposed to report anything unusual. That's the directive. And I thought..." Quickly, not giving Brodsky time to think, Owen rapped, "What was his name?" "Jonesy 3, Dog replied, and then his eyes widened in surprise. "Holy shit! I didn't know I knew that. Is that some sort of Indian name, do you think, like Sonny Six Killer or Ron Nine Moons?" "Could have been, but..." Brodsky paused, thinking, then burst out, "It was awful, not when it was happening, but later on. Thinking about it, it was like being..." He dropped his voice. "Like being raped, sir." "Let it go," Owen said. "You must have a few things to do." Brodsky smiled. "Only a few thousand. Then get started." "Okay." Brodsky took a step away, then turned back. Owen was looking toward the corral, which had once held horses and now held men. Most of the detainees were in the barn, and all but one of the 2 dozen or so out here were huddled up together as if for comfort. The one who stood apart was a tall, skinny drink of water wearing big glasses that made him look sort of like an owl. Brodsky looked from the doomed owl to Underhill.
You're not going to get me in hack over this, are you? Send me to see the shrink?
Unaware, of course, both of them unaware that the skinny guy in the old-fashioned horn rims was a shrink.
Not a ch—
Owen began. Before he could finish, there was a gunshot from Kurtz's Winnebago, and someone began to scream.
Boss? Brodsky whispered.
Owen couldn't hear him over the contending motors. He read the word off Brodsky's lips. And?
Oh, fuck!
Go on, dog, Owen said. Not your business.
Brodsky looked at him a moment longer, wetting his lips inside of his mask. Owen gave him a nod, trying to project an air of confidence, of command, of everything's under control. Maybe it worked, because Brodsky returned the nod and started away. From the Winnebago with the hand-lettered sign on the door, "The buck stops here," the screaming continued. As Owen started that way, the man standing by himself in the compound spoke to him.
Hey, you, stop a minute, I need to talk to you.
I'll bet, Underhill thought, not slowing his pace. I'll bet you've got a whale of a tale to tell and 1,000 reasons why you should be let out of here right now.
Overhill? No, Underhill? That's your name, isn't it? Sure it is. I have to talk to you. It's important for both of us.
Owen stopped in spite of the screaming from the Winnebago, which was breaking up into hurt sobs now. Not good, but at least it seemed that no one had been killed. He took a closer look at the man in the spectacles, skinny as a rail and shivering in spite of the down parka he was wearing.
It's important to Rita, the skinny man called over the contending roar of the engines. To Katrina, too!
Speaking the names seemed to sap the geeky guy, as if he had drawn them up like stones from some deep well. But in his shock at hearing the names of his wife and daughter from this stranger's lips, Owen barely noticed. The urge to go to the man and ask him how he knew those names was strong, but he was currently out of time. He had an appointment. And just because no one had been killed yet didn't mean no one would be killed. Owen gave the man behind the wire a final look, marking his face, and then hurried on toward the Winnebago with the sign on the door. Perlmutter had read Heart of Darkness, had seen Apocalypse Now, and had on many occasions thought that the name Kurtz was simply a little too convenient. He would have bet $100, a great sum for a non-wagering artistic fellow such as himself, that it wasn't the boss's real name, that the boss's real name was Arthur Holsapple or Dagwood Elgart, maybe even Paddy Maloney. Kurtz? Unlikely. It was almost surely an affectation, as much a prop as George Patton's Pearl handled 45. The men, some of whom had been with Kurtz since Desert Storm, Archie Perlmutter didn't go back nearly that far, thought he was one crazy motherfucker, and so did Perlmutter. Crazy like Patton had been crazy. Crazy like a fox, in other words. Probably when he was shaving in the morning, he looked at his reflection and practiced saying, "The horror, the horror," in just the right Marlon Brando whisper. So Pearly felt disquiet, but no unusual disquiet, as he escorted Cook's third, Melrose, into the overwarm command trailer. And Kurtz looked pretty much okay. The skipper was sitting in a cane rocking chair in the living room area. He had removed his coverall, it hung on the door through which Perlmutter and Melrose had entered, and received them in his long johns. From one post of the rocking chair, his pistol hung by its belt, not a Pearl-handled 45, but a 9mm automatic. All the electronic gear was rebounding. On Kurtz's desk, the fax hummed constantly, piling up paper. Every 15 seconds or so, Kurtz's iMac cried, "You've got mail," in its cheery robot voice. Three radios, all turned low, crackled and hopped with transmissions. Mounted on the fake pine behind the desk were two framed photographs. Like the sign on the door, the photos went with Kurtz everywhere. The one on the left, titled Investment, showed an angelic young fellow in a Boy Scout uniform, right hand raised in the three-fingered Boy Scout salute. The one on the right, labeled Dividend, was an aerial photograph of Berlin taken in the spring of 1945. Two or three buildings still stood, but mostly what the camera showed was witless, brick-strewn rubble. Kurtz waved his hand at the desk.
Don't mind all that, boys. It's just noise. I've got Freddie Johnson to deal with it, but I sent him over to the commissary to grab some chow. Told him to take his time, go through the whole four courses, soup to nuts, poisson to sorbet, because this situation here, boys, this situation here is near about stabilized.
He gave them a ferocious FDR grin and began to rock in his chair. Beside him, the pistol swung in the holster at the end of its belt like a pendulum. Melrose returned Kurtz's smile tentatively, Perlmutter with less reserve. He had Kurtz's number all right. His boss was an existential wannabe, and you wanted to believe that was a good call, a brilliant call. A liberal arts education didn't have many benefits in the career military, but there were a few. Phrase-making was one of them.
My only order to Lieutenant Johnson, whoops, no rank on this one, to my good pal, Freddie Johnson, is what I meant to say, was that he say grace before chowing in. Do you pray, boys?
Melrose nodded as tentatively as he had smiled. Perlmutter did so indulgently. He felt sure that, like his name, Kurtz's oft-professed belief in God was plumage. Kurtz rocked, looking happily at the two men with the snow melting from their footgear and puddling on the floor.
The best prayers are the child's prayers, Kurtz said. The simplicity. You know, God is great. God is good. Let us thank him for our food. Isn't that simple? Isn't it beautiful?
Yes, Pearlie began.
Shut the fuck up, you hound, Kurtz said cheerfully. Still rocking, the gun still swinging back and forth at the end of its belt, he looked from Pearlie to Melrose. What do you think, Laddiebuck? Is that a beautiful little prayer, or is that a beautiful little prayer?
Yes, sir.
Or Allah Akbar, as our Arab friends say. There is no God but God. What could be more simple than that? It cuts the pizza directly down the middle, if you see what I mean.
They didn't reply. Kurtz was rocking faster now, and the pistol was swinging faster, and Perlmutter began to feel a little antsy, as he had earlier in the day, before Underhill had arrived and sort of cooled Kurtz out. This was probably just more plumage, but...
Or Moses at the burning bush, Kurtz cried,
his lean and rather horsey face lit with a daffy smile.
Who am I talking to, Moses asks. And God gives him the old I am what I am, and that's all that I am. Ark, 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 what a kidder that God, eh, Mr. Melrose? Did you really refer to our emissaries from the great beyond as space niggers?
Melrose's mouth dropped open.
Answer me, Buck.
Sir, I...
Call me sir again while the group is hot, Mr. Melrose, and you will celebrate your next two birthdays in the stockade. Do you understand that? Catch my old driftola?
Yes, boss.
Melrose had snapped to attention, his face dead white except for the patches of cold-induced red on his cheeks, patches that were cut neatly in two by the straps of his mask.
Now, did you, or did you not, refer to our visitors as space niggers?
Sir, I may have just in passing said something.
Moving with a speed Perlmutter could scarcely credit. It was like a special effect in a James Cameron movie, almost. Kurtz snatched the 9mm from the swinging holster, pointed it without seeming to aim, and fired. The top half of the sneaker on Melrose's left foot exploded. Fragments of canvas flew. Blood and flecks of flesh splattered Perlmutter's pants leg. I didn't see that, Pearlie thought. That didn't happen. But Melrose was screaming, looking down at his ruined left foot with agonized disbelief and howling his head off. Perlmutter could see bone in there and felt his stomach turn over. Kurtz didn't get himself out of his rocker as quickly as he'd gotten his gun out of his holster. Perlmutter could at least see this happening, but it was still fast, spookily fast. He grabbed Melrose by the shoulder and peered into the cook third's contorted face with great intensity.
Stop that blatting, Laddiebuck.
Melrose carried on blatting. His foot was gushing, and the part with the toes on it looked to Pearly as if it might be severed from the part with the heel on it. Pearly's world went gray and started to lose focus. With all the force of his will, he forced that grayness away. If he passed out now, Christ alone knew what Kurtz might do to him. Perlmutter had heard stories and had dismissed 90% of them out of hand, thinking that they were either exaggerations or Kurtz-planted propaganda designed to enhance his loony, crafty image. "Now I know better," Perlmutter thought. "This isn't myth-making. This is the myth." Kurtz, moving with a finicky, almost surgical precision, placed the barrel of his pistol against the center of Melrose's cheese-white forehead.
"Squelch that womanish bawling, Buck, or I'll squelch it for you. These are hollow points, as I think even a dimly lit American like yourself must now surely know."
Melrose somehow choked the screams off, turned them into low, in-the-throat sobs. This seemed to satisfy Kurtz.
"Just so you can hear me, Buck. You have to hear me, because you have to spread the word. I believe, praise God, that your foot, what's left of it, will articulate the basic concept. But it's your own sacred mouth that must share the details. So are you listening, Bucko? Are you listening for the details?"
Still sobbing, his eyes starting from his face like blue glass balls, Melrose managed a nod. Quick as a striking snake, Kurtz's head turned, and Perlmutter clearly saw the man's face. The madness there was stamped into the features as clearly as a warrior's tattoos. At that moment, everything Perlmutter had ever believed about his OIC fell down.
"What about you, Bucko? Listening? Because you're a messenger, too. All of us are messengers."
Pearly nodded. The door opened, and he saw with unutterable relief that the newcomer was Owen Underhill. Kurtz's eyes flew to him.
"Owen, me fine Bucko! Another witness! Another, praise God, another messenger! Ye listening? Will you carry the word hence from this happy place?"
Expressionless as a poker player in a high-stakes game, Underhill nodded.
"Good. Good."
Kurtz returned his attention to Melrose.
"I quote from the Manual of Affairs, Cook's Third Melrose, Part 16, Section 4, Paragraph 3. Use of inappropriate epithets, whether racial, ethnic, or gender-based, are counterproductive to morale and run counter to armed service protocol. When use is proven, the user will be punished immediately by court-martial or in the field by appropriate command personnel," end quote.
Appropriate command personnel. That's me. User of inappropriate epithets. That's you. Do you understand, Melrose? Do you get the drift, Ola? Melrose, blubbering, tried to speak, but Kurtz cut him off. In the doorway, Owen Underhill continued to stand completely still as the snow melted on his shoulders and ran down the transparent bulb of his mask like sweat. His eyes remained fixed on Kurtz.
"Now, Cook's Third Melrose, what I have quoted to you in the presence of these praise God witnesses, is called an order of conduct. And it means no spick-pick talk, no mocky talk, no kraut talk, or redskin talk. It also means, as is most applicable in the current situation, no space nigger talk. Do you understand that?"
Melrose tried to nod, then reeled on the verge of passing out. Perlmutter grabbed him by the shoulder and got him straight again, praying that Melrose wouldn't conk before this was over. God only knew what Kurtz might do to Melrose if Melrose had the temerity to turn out the lights before Kurtz was done reading him the riot act.
We are going to wipe these invading assholes out, my friend, and if they ever come back to Terra Firma, we are going to rip off their collective gray head and shit down their collective gray neck. If they persist, we will use their own technology, which we are already well on our way to grasping, against them, returning to their place of origin in their own ships, or ships like them, built by General Electric and DuPont and, praise God, Microsoft. And once there, we will burn their cities or hives or goddamn anthills, whatever they live in. We'll napalm their amber waves of grain and nuke their purple mountains' majesty, praise God, Allah Akbar. We will pour the fiery piss of America into their lakes and oceans. But we will do it in a way that is proper and appropriate and without regard to race or gender or ethnicity or religious preference. We're going to do it because they came to the wrong neighborhood and knocked on the wrong fucking door. This is not Germany in 1938 or Oxford, Mississippi in 1963. Now, Mr. Melrose, do you think you can spread that message?
Melrose's eyes rolled up to the wet whites, and his knees unhinged. Perlmutter once more grabbed his shoulder in an effort to hold him up, but it was a lost cause this time. Down Melrose went.
Pearly, Kurtz whispered,
and when those burning blue eyes fell on him, Perlmutter thought he had never been so frightened in his life. His bladder was a hot and heavy bag inside him, wanting only to squirt its contents into his coverall. He felt that if Kurtz saw a dark patch spreading on his adjutant's crotch, Kurtz might shoot him out of hand in his present mood. But that didn't seem to help the situation. In fact, it made it worse.
Yes, boss, will he spread the word? Will he be a good messenger? Do you reckon he took enough in to do that? Or was he too concerned with his damned old foot?
I... In the doorway, he saw Underhill nod at him almost imperceptibly, and Pearly took heart.
Yes, boss. I think he heard you five by.
Kurtz seemed first surprised by Perlmutter's vehemence, then gratified. He turned to Underhill.
What about you, Owen? Do you think he'll spread the word?
Uh-huh, Underhill said. If you get him to the infirmary before he bleeds to death on your rug.
Kurtz's mouth turned up at the corners, and he barked.
See to that, Pearly, will you?
Right now, Perlmutter said, starting toward the door. Once past Kurtz, he gave Underhill a look of fervent gratitude which Underhill either missed or chose not to acknowledge.
Double time, Mr. Perlmutter. Oh, and I want to talk to you mano a mano, as the Irish say.
He stepped over Melrose's body without looking down at it and walked briskly into the kitchenette.
Coffee? Freddy made it, so I can't swear it's drinkable. No, I can't swear, but...
Coffee would be good, Owen Underhill said. You pour, and I'll try to stop this fellow's bleeding. Kurtz stood by the Mr. Coffee on the counter and gave Underhill a look of darkly brilliant doubt.
Do you really think that's necessary?
That was where Perlmutter went out. Never before in his life had stepping into a storm felt so much like an escape. Henry stood at the fence, not touching the wire. He had seen what happened when you did that, waiting for Underhill. That was his name, all right, to come back out of what had to be the command post. But when the door opened, one of the other fellows he'd seen go in came hustling out. Once down the steps, the guy started running. The guy was tall and possessed one of those earnest faces Henry associated with middle management. Now the face looked terrified, and the man almost fell before he got fully into stride. Henry was rooting for that. The middle manager managed to keep his balance after the first slip, but halfway to a couple of semi-trailers as it had been pushed together, his feet flew out from beneath him, and he went on his ass. The clipboard he'd been carrying went sliding like a toboggan for leprechauns. Henry held his hands out, clapped as loudly as he could. Probably not loud enough to be heard over all the motors, so he cupped them around his mouth and yelled,
"Way to go, shitheels! Let's look at the videotape!"
The middle manager got up without looking at him, retrieved his clipboard, and ran on toward the two semi-trailers. There was a group of 8 or 9 guys standing by the fence about 20 yards from Henry. Now one of them, a portly fellow in an orange downfield parka that made him look like the Pillsbury Doughboy, walked over. "I don't think you should do that, fella." He paused, then lowered his voice. "They shot my brother-in-law." Yes, Henry saw it in the man's head. The portly man's brother-in-law, also portly, talking about his lawyer, his rights, his job with some investment company in Boston. The soldiers nodding, telling him it was just temporary. The situation was normalizing and would be straightened out by dawn, all the time hustling the two overweight mighty hunters toward the barn, which already held a pretty good trawl. And all at once, the brother-in-law had broken away, running toward the motor pool, and boom, boom, out go the lights. The portly man was telling Henry some of this, his pale face earnest in the newly erected lights, and Henry interrupted him. "What do you think they're going to do to the rest of us?" The portly man looked at Henry shocked, then backed off a step, as if he thought Henry might have something contagious. Quite funny when you thought about it, because they all had something contagious, or at least this team of government-funded cleaners thought they did. And in the end, it would come to the same. "You can't be serious," the portly man said. Then almost indulgently, "This is America, you know." "Is it? You seeing a lot of due process, are you?" I'm sure they're just..." Henry waited, interested, but there was no more, at least not in this vein. "That was a gunshot, wasn't it?" the portly man asked. "And I think I heard some screaming." From the two pushed-together trailers, there emerged two hurrying men with a stretcher between them. Following them with marked reluctance came the middle manager, his clipboard once more tucked firmly beneath his arm. "I'd say you got that right." Henry and the portly man watched as the stretcher-bearers hurried up the steps of the Winnebago. As Mr. Middle Management made his closest approach to the fence, Henry called out to him. "How's it going, shitheels? Having any fun yet?" The portly man winced. The guy with the clipboard gave Henry a single, dour look and then trudged on toward the Winnebago. "This is just... it's just some sort of emergency situation," the portly man said. "It'll be straightened out by tomorrow morning, I'm sure." "Not for your brother-in-law," Henry said. The portly man looked at him, mouth tucked in and trembling slightly. Then he returned to the other men, whose views no doubt more closely corresponded to his own. Henry turned back to the Winnebago and resumed waiting for Underhill to come out. He had an idea that Underhill was his only hope. But whatever Underhill's doubts about this operation might be, the hope was a thin one. And Henry had only one card to play. The card was Jonesy. They didn't know about Jonesy. The question was whether or not he should tell Underhill. Henry was terribly afraid that telling the man would do no good. About 5 minutes after Mr. Middle Management followed the stretcher-bearers into the Bago, the three of them came out again, this time with a fourth on the stretcher. Under the brilliant overhead lights, the wounded man's face was so pale it looked purple. Henry was relieved to see that it wasn't Underhill, because Underhill was different from the rest of these maniacs. 10 minutes passed. Underhill still hadn't come out of the command post. Henry waited in the thickening snow. There were soldiers watching the inmates. That's what they were, inmates, and it was best not to gild the lily. And eventually one of them strolled over. The men who had been stationed at the T-junction of the Deep Cut and Swanee Pond roads had pretty well blinded Henry with their lights, and he didn't recognize this man by his face. Henry was both delighted and deeply unsettled to realize that minds also had features, every bit as distinctive as a pretty mouth, a broken nose, or a crooked eye. This was one of the guys who had been out there, the one who had hit him in the ass with the stock of his rifle when he decided Henry wasn't moving toward the truck fast enough. Whatever had happened to Henry's mind was skitsy. He couldn't pick out this guy's name, but he knew that the man's brother's name was Frankie, and that in high school, Frankie had been tried and acquitted on a rape charge. There was more as well, unconnected jumbles of stuff like the contents of a wastebasket. Henry realized that he was looking at an actual river of consciousness, and at the flotsam and jetsam the river was carrying along. The humbling thing was how prosaic most of it was.
Hey there, the soldier said amiably enough. It's the smartass. On a hot dog, smartass? He laughed.
Already got one, Henry said, smiling himself. And Beaver popped up out of his mouth, as Beaver had a way of doing.
Fuck off, Freddy.
The soldier stopped laughing.
Let's see how smart your ass is 12 hours from now, he said.
The image that went floating by, borne on the river between this man's ears, was of a truck filled with bodies, white limbs all tangled together.
You growing the Ripley yet, smartass?
Henry thought, the virus. That's what he means. The virus is what it's really called. Jonesy knows. Henry didn't reply, and the soldier started away, wearing the comfortable look of a man who has won on points. Curious, Henry summoned all his concentration and visualized a rifle. Jonesy's Garand, as a matter of fact. He thought, I have a gun. I'm going to kill you with it the second you turn your back on me, asshole. The soldier swung around again, the comfortable look going the way of the grin and the laughter. What replaced it was a look of doubt and suspicion.
What do you say, smartass? You say something? Just wondering if you got your share of that girl. You know, the one Frankie broke in? Did he give you sloppy seconds?
For a moment, the soldier's face was idiotic with surprise. Then it filled in with black Italian rage. He raised his rifle. To Henry, its muzzle looked like a smile. He unzipped his jacket and held it open in the thickening snow.
Go on, he said and laughed. Go on, Rambo, do your thing.
Frankie's brother held the gun on Henry a moment longer, and then Henry felt the man's rage pass. It had been close. He had seen the soldier trying to think of what he would say, some plausible story, but he had taken a moment too long, and his forebrain had pulled the red beast back to heel. It was all so familiar. The Richie Grenadoes never died, not really. They were the world's dragon's teeth.
Tomorrow, the soldier said. Tomorrow's time enough for you, smartass.
This time Henry let him go. No more teasing the red beast, although God knew it would have been easy enough. He had learned something, too, or confirmed what he'd already suspected. The soldier had heard his thought, but not clearly. If he'd heard it clearly, he would have turned around a lot faster. Nor had he asked Henry how Henry knew about his brother Frankie, because on some level, the soldier knew what Henry did. They had been infected with telepathy, the whole walking bunch of them. They had caught it like an annoying, low-grade virus. Only I got it worse, he said, zipping his jacket back up again. So had Pete and Beaver and Jonesy. But Pete and the Beav were both dead now, and Jonesy got it worst of all, Henry said. And where was Jonesy now? South. Jonesy had hooked back south. These guys' precious quarantine had been breached. Henry guessed they had foreseen that that might happen. It didn't worry them. They thought one or two breaches wouldn't matter. Henry thought they were wrong. Owen stood with a mug of coffee in his hand, waiting until the guys from the infirmary were gone with their burden. Melrose's sobs mercifully reduced to mutters and moans by a shot of morphine. Pearlie followed them out, and then Owen was alone with Kurtz. Kurtz sat in his rocker, looking up at Owen Underhill, with curious, head-cocked amusement. The raving crazy man was gone again, put away like a Halloween mask.
I'm thinking of a number, Kurtz said. What is it?
17, Owen said. You see it in red, like on the side of a fire engine. Kurtz nodded, pleased.
You try sending one to me.
Owen visualized a speed limit sign. 60 miles per hour.
6, Kurtz said after a moment.
Black on white.
Close enough, boss. Kurtz drank some coffee. His was in a mug with I Love My Grandpa printed on the side. Owen sipped with honest pleasure. It was a dirty night and a dirty job, and Freddy's coffee wasn't bad. Kurtz had found time to put on his coverall. Now he reached into the inner pocket and brought out a large bandana. He regarded it for a moment, then got to his knees with a grimace. It was no secret that the old man had arthritis, and began to wipe up the splatters of Melrose's blood. Owen, who thought himself surely unshockable at this point, was shocked.
Sir.
Oh, fuck.
Boss.
Stow it, Kurt said without looking up. He moved from spot to spot, as assiduous as any washerwoman.
My father always said you should clean up your own messes. Might make you stop and think a little bit the next time. What was my father's name, Buck?
Owen looked for it and caught just a glimpse, like a glimpse of slip under a woman's dress.
Paul? Patrick, actually. But close. Anderson believes it's a wave, and it's expending its force now. A telepathic wave. Do you find that an awesome concept, Owen?
Yes.
Kurtz nodded without looking up, wiping and cleaning.
More awesome in concept than in fact, however. Do you also find that?
Owen laughed. The old man had lost none of his capacity to surprise. Not playing with a full deck, people sometimes said of unstable individuals. The trouble with Kurtz, Owen reckoned, was that he was playing with more than a full deck. A few extra aces in there. Also a few extra deuces, and everyone knew that deuces were wild.
Sit down, Owen. Drink your coffee on your ass like a normal person, and let me do this. I need to.
Owen thought maybe he did. He sat down and drank the coffee. 5 minutes passed in this fashion, then Kurtz got painfully back to his feet. Holding the bandana fastidiously by one corner, he carried it to the kitchen, dropped it into the trash, and returned to his rocker. He took a sip of his coffee, grimaced, and put it aside.
Cold.
Owen rose. I'll get you a fresh...
No, sit down.
We need to talk. Owen sat.
We had a little confrontation out there at the ship, you and I, didn't we?
I wouldn't say.
No, I know you wouldn't. But I know what went on, and so do you. When the situation's hot, tempers also get hot. But we're past that now. We have to be past it. Because I'm the OIC, and you're my second, and we've still got this job to finish. Can we work together to do that?
Yes, sir.
Fuck, there it was again. Boss, I mean. Kurtz favored him with a wintry smile. I lost control just now. Charming, frank, open-eyed and honest. This had fooled Owen for a lot of years. It did not fool him now. I was going along, drawing the usual caricature, two parts Patton, one part Rasputin, add water, stir and serve, and I just, whew, I just lost it. You think I'm crazy, don't you?
Careful, careful, there was telepathy in this room, honest to God telepathy, and Owen had no idea how deeply Kurtz might be able to see into him.
Yes, sir. A little, sir. Kurtz nodded matter-of-factly.
Yes, a little. That pretty well describes it. I've been doing this for a long time. Men like me are necessary but hard to find, and you have to be a little crazy to do the job and not just high-side it completely. It's a thin line, that famous thin line the armchair psychologists love to talk about, and never in the history of the world has there been a clean-up job like this one. Assuming, that is, the story of Hercules neatening up the Aegean stables is just a myth. I'm not asking for your sympathy, but for your understanding. If we understand each other, we'll get through this, the hardest job we've ever had. All right. If we don't, Kurtz shrugged. If we don't, I'll have to get through it without you. Are you following me?
Owen doubted if he was, but he saw where Kurtz wanted him to go and nodded. He had read that there was a certain kind of bird that lived in the crocodile's mouth at the croc's sufferance. He supposed that now he must be that kind of bird. Kurtz wanted him to believe he was forgiven for putting the alien broadcast on the common channel, heat of the moment, just as Kurtz had blown off Melrose's foot in the heat of the moment. And what had happened 6 years ago in Bosnia? Not a factor now. Maybe it was true. And maybe the crocodile had tired of the bird's tiresome pecking and was preparing to close its jaws. Owen got no sense of the truth from Kurtz's mind, and either way, it behooved him to be very careful. Careful and ready to fly. Kurtz reached into his coverall again and brought out a tarnished pocket watch.
"This was my grandfather's, and it works just fine," he said, "because it winds up, I think. No electricity. My wristwatch, on the other hand, is still foobar.
Mine, too." Kurtz's lips twitched in a smile. "See Perlmutter when you have a chance and feel you have the stomach for him. Among his many other chores and activities, he found time to take delivery of 300 wind-up Timexes this afternoon. Just before the snow shut down our air ops, this was. Pearlie's damned efficient. I just wish to Christ he'd get over the idea that he's living in a movie. He may have made strides in that direction tonight, boss."
Perhaps he has at that.
Kurtz meditated. Underhill waited.
"Laddiebuck, we should be drinking the whiskey. It's a bit of an Irish death watch we're having tonight."
"Is it?"
"Aye, me beloved Pooka is about to keel over dead."
Owen raised his eyebrows.
"Yes, at which point its magical cloak of invisibility will be whisked away. Then it will become just another dead horse for folks to beat, primarily politicians who are best at that sort of thing."
"I don't follow you." Kurtz took another look at the tarnished pocket watch, which he'd probably picked up in a pawn shop or looted off a corpse. Underhill wouldn't have doubted either.
"It's 7 o'clock. In just about 40 hours, the president is going to speak before the UN General Assembly. More people are going to see and hear that speech than any previous speech in the history of the human race. It's going to be part of the biggest story in the history of the human race, and the biggest spin job since God the Father Almighty created the cosmos and sent the planets going round and round with the tip of his finger."
"What's the spin?"
"It's a beautiful tale, Owen. Like the best lies, it incorporates large swatches of the truth. The president will tell a fascinated world, a world hanging on every word with its breath caught in its throat, praise Jesus, that a ship crewed by beings from another world crashed in northern Maine on either November 6th or November 7th of this year. That's true. He will say that we were not completely surprised, as we and the heads of the other countries which constitute the UN Security Council have known for at least 10 years that E.T. has been scoping us out. Also true. Only some of us here in America have known about our pals from the void since the late 1940s. We also know that Russian fighters destroyed a Grey Boy ship over Siberia in 1974, although to this day the Ruskies don't know we know. That one was probably a drone, a test shot. There have been a lot of those. The Greys have handled their early contacts with a care which strongly suggests that we scare them quite a lot."
Owen listened with a sick fascination he hoped it didn't show on his face or at the top level of his thoughts where Kurtz might still have access. From his inner pocket, Kurtz now brought out a dented box of Marlboro cigarettes. He offered the pack to Owen, who first shook his head, then took one of the remaining 4 fags. Kurtz took another, then lit them up.
"I'm getting the truth and the spin mixed in together," Kurtz said after he'd taken a deep drag and exhaled. "That may not be the most profitable way to get on. Let's stick to the spin, shall we?"
Owen said nothing. He smoked rarely these days, and the first drag made him feel lightheaded, but the taste was wonderful.
"The president will say that the United States government quarantined the crash site and the area around it for 3 reasons. The first was purely logistical. Because of the Jefferson Tract's remote location and low population, we could quarantine it. If the Grey Boys had come down in Brooklyn or even on Long Island, that would not have been the case. The second reason is that we are not clear on the aliens' intentions. The third reason, and ultimately the most persuasive, is that the aliens carry with them an infectious substance which the unseen personnel calls Ripley fungus,
While the alien visitors have assured us passionately that they are not infectious, they have brought a highly infectious substance with them. The president will also tell a horrified world that the fungus may in fact be the controlling intelligence. The gray boy is just a growth medium. He will show videotape of a gray boy literally exploding into the Ripley fungus. The footage has been slightly doctored to improve visibility, but is basically true.
You're lying, Owen thought. The footage is entirely fake from beginning to end, as fake as that alien autopsy shit. And why are you lying?
Because you can. It's as simple as that, isn't it? Because to you, a lie comes more naturally than the truth.
Okay, I'm lying, Kurtz said, never missing a beat. He gave Owen a quick, gleaming look before dropping his gaze to his cigarette again.
But the facts are true and verifiable. Some of them do explode and turn into red dandelion fluff. The fluff is Ripley. You inhale enough of it, and in a period of time we can't yet predict, it could be an hour or 2 days, your lungs and brain are Ripley salad. You look like a walking patch of poison sumac, and then you die. There will be no mention of our little venture earlier today. According to the president's version, the ship, which had apparently been badly damaged in the crash, was either blown up by its crew or blew up on its own. All the gray boys were killed. The Ripley, after some initial spread, is also dying, apparently because it does very poorly in the cold. The Russians corroborate that, by the way. There's been a fairly large kill-off of animals, which also carry the infection. And the human population of Jefferson Tract? POTUS is going to say that about 300 people, 70 or so locals, and about 230 hunters are currently being monitored for the Ripley fungus. He will say that while some appear to have been infected, they also appear to be beating the infection with the help of such standard antibiotics as Ceftin and Augmentin. And now this word from our sponsor, Owen said. Kurtz laughed, delighted. At a later time, it's going to be announced that the Ripley seems a little more antibiotic resistant than was first believed, and the number of patients have died. The names we give out will be those of people who have in fact already died, either as a result of the Ripley or those gruesome fucking implants. Do you know what the men are calling the implants? Yeah, shit weasels. Will the president mention them? No way. The guys in charge believe the shit weasels are just a little too upsetting for John Q. Public, as would be, of course, the facts concerning our solution to the problem here at Goslin's store, that rustic beauty spot. The final solution, you could call it, Owen said. He had smoked his cigarette all the way down to the filter, and now crushed it out on the rim of his empty coffee cup. Kurtz's eyes rose to Owen's and met them unflinchingly.
Yes, you could call it that. We're going to wipe out approximately 350 people. Mostly men, there's that, but I can't say the cleansing won't include at least a few women and children. The upside, of course, is that we will be ensuring the human race against a pandemic and, very possibly, subjugation. Not an inconsiderable upside. Owens thought, but I'm sure Hitler would like the spin, was unstoppable. But he covered it as well as he could, and got no sense that Kurtz had heard it or sensed it. Impossible to tell for sure, of course. Kurtz was sly.
How many are we holding now? Kurtz asked.
About 70, and twice that number on the way from Kineo. They'll be here around 9 if the weather doesn't get any worse. It was supposed to, but not until after midnight. Kurtz was nodding.
Uh-huh. Plus, I'm going to say 50 more from up north, 70 or so from St. Cap's and those little places down south. And our guys, don't forget them. The masks seem to work, but we've already picked up 4 cases at Ripley in the medical debriefings. The men, of course, don't know.
Don't they?
Let me rephrase that, Kurt said. Based on their behavior, I have no reason to believe the men know.
All right? Owen shrugged.
The story, Kurtz resumed, will be that the detainees are being flown to a top-secret medical installation, a kind of Area 51, where they will undergo further examination and, if necessary, long-term treatment.
there will never be another official statement concerning them, not if all goes according to plan, but there will be time release leaks over the next 2 years, encroaching infection despite best medical efforts to stop it, madness, grotesque physical changes better left undescribed, and finally, death comes as a mercy. Far from being outraged, the public will be relieved. While in reality, he wanted to hear Kurtz say it, but he should have known better. There were no bugs here, except maybe for the ones hiding between Kurtz's ears, but the boss's caution was ingrained. He raised one hand, made a gun of his thumb and forefinger, and dropped his thumb 3 times. His eyes never left Owen's as he did this. Crocodile's eyes, Owen thought. All of them? Owen asked. The ones who aren't showing Ripley positive as well as those who are? And where does that leave us, the soldiers who also show negative?
The laddies who are okay now are going to stay okay, Kurtz said. Those showing Ripley were all careless. One of them, well, there's a little girl out there, about 4 years old, cute as the devil. You almost expect her to start tap dancing across the barn floor and singing On the Good Ship Lollipop.
Kurtz obviously thought he was being witty, and Owen supposed that in a way he was, but Owen himself was overcome by a wave of intense horror. There's a 4-year-old out there, he thought. Just 4 years old. How about that?
She's cute, and she's hot, Kurtz was saying.
Visible Ripley on the inside of one wrist, growing at her hairline, growing in the corner of one eye. Classic spots. Anyway, this soldier gave her a candy bar, just like she was some starving Kosovar rug muncher, and she gave him a kiss. Sweet as pie, a real Kodak moment, only now he's got a lipstick print that ain't lipstick growing on his cheek. Kurtz grimaced. He had himself a little tiny shaving cut, barely visible, but there goes your ball game. Similar stuff with the others. The rules don't change, Owen. Carelessness gets you killed. You may go along lucky for a while, but in the end, it never fails. Carelessness gets you killed. Most of our guys, I'm delighted to say, will walk away from this. We're going to face scheduled medical exams for the rest of our lives, not to mention the occasional surprise exam, but look at the upside. They're going to catch your ass cancer wicked early. The civilians who appear clean, what about them? Kurtz leaned forward, now at his most charming, his most persuasively sane. You were supposed to be flattered by this, to feel yourself one of the fortunate few to see Kurtz with his mask, 2 parts Patton, 1 part Rasputin, add water, stir, and serve, laid aside. It had worked on Owen before, but not now. Rasputin wasn't the mask. This was the mask. Yet even now, here was the hell of it. He wasn't completely sure. Owen, 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 use your brain. That good brain God gave you. We can monitor our own without raising suspicions or opening the door to a worldwide panic. And there's going to be enough panic anyway after our narrowly elected president slays the puka horse. We couldn't do that with 300 civilians. And if we really flew them out to New Mexico, put them up in some model village for 50 or 70 years at the taxpayer's expense? What if one or more of them escaped? Or what if, and I think this is what the smart boys are really afraid of, given time, the Ripley mutates. That instead of dying off, it turns into something a lot more infectious and a lot less vulnerable to the environmental factors that are killing it here in Maine. If the Ripley's intelligent, it's dangerous. Even if it isn't, what if it serves the Gray Boys as a kind of beacon, an interstellar road flare marking our world out? Yum, yum, come and get it. These guys are tasty. There's plenty of them. You're saying better safe than sorry. Kurtz leaned back in his chair and beamed. That's it. That's it in a nutshell. Well, one thought, it might be the nut. But the shell is something we're not talking about. We watch out for our own. We're merciless if we have to be, but even Kurtz watches out for his laddie bucks. Civilians, on the other hand, are just civilians. If you need to burn them, they go up pretty easy.
If you doubt there's a God,
and that he spends at least some of his time looking out for good old Homo sape, you might look at the way we're coming out of this, Kurtz said. The flashlights arrived early and were reported. One of the reports came from the store owner, Reginald Goslin himself. Then the Gray Boys arrive at the only time of year when there are actually people in these godforsaken woods, and two of them saw the ship go down. That was lucky.
God's grace is what it was.
Their ship crashes, their presence is known, the cold kills both them and the galactic dandruff they brought along. He ticked the points off rapidly on his long fingers, his white eyelashes blinking. But that's not all. They do some implants, and the goddamn things don't work. Far from establishing a harmonious relationship with their hosts, they turn cannibal and kill them. The animal kill-off went well. We've censused something like 100,000 critters, and there's already one hell of a barbecue going on over by the Castle County line. In the spring or summer, we would have needed to worry about bugs carrying the Ripley out of the zone, but not now. Not in November.
Some animals must have gotten through.
Animals and people both, likely. But the Ripley spread slowly. We're going to be all right on this because we netted the vast majority of infected hosts, because the ship has been destroyed, and because what they brought us smolders rather than blazes. We've sent them a simple message. Come in peace, or come with your ray guns blazing, but don't try it this way again because it doesn't work. We don't think they will come again, or at least not for a while. They played fiddly-fuck for half a century before getting this far. Our only regret is that we didn't secure the ship for the science boffins. But it might have been too Ripley infected anyway. Do you know what our great fear has been? That either the Gray Boys or the Ripley would find a Typhoid Mary. Someone who could carry it and spread it without catching it him or herself. Are you sure there isn't such a person? Almost sure. If there is, well, that's what the cordon's for. Kurtz smiled. We lucked out, soldier. The odds are against the Typhoid Mary. The Gray Boys are dead, and all the Ripley is confined to the Jefferson Tract. Luck or God, take your choice. Kurtz lowered his head and pinched the bridge of his nose high up like a man suffering a sinus infection. When he looked up again, his eyes were swimming. Crocodile tears, Owen thought, but in truth he wasn't sure. And he had no access to Kurtz's mind. Either the telepathic wave had receded too far for that, or Kurtz had found a way to slam the door. Yet, when Kurtz spoke again, Owen was almost positive he was hearing the real Kurtz, a human being, and not Tick-Tock the Croc.
This is it for me, Owen. Once this job is finished, I'm going to punch my time. There'll be work here for another 4 days, I guess. Maybe a week if this storm's as bad as they say. And it'll be nasty. But the real nightmare's tomorrow morning. I can hold up my end, I guess. But after that, well, I'm eligible for full retirement, and I'm going to give them their choice, pay me or kill me. I think they'll pay because I know where too many of the bodies are buried. That's a lesson I learned from J. Edgar Hoover. But I've almost reached the point of not caring. This won't be the worst one I've ever been involved in. In Haiti, we did 800 in a single hour. 1989, that was, and I still dream about it. But this is worse. By far. Because those poor schmucks out there in the barn and the paddock and the corral, they're Americans. Folks who drive Chevys. Shop at Kmart and never miss ER. The thought of shooting Americans. Massacring Americans. That turns my stomach. I'll do it. Only because it needs to be done in order to bring closure to this business. And because most of them would die anyway. And much more horribly. Capiche?
Owen Underhill said nothing. He thought he was keeping his face properly expressionless, but anything he said would likely give away his sinking horror. He had known this was coming, but to actually hear it,
In his mind's eye, he saw the soldiers drifting toward the fence through the snow, heard the loudspeakers summoning the detainees in the barn. He had never been part of an operation like this. He'd missed Haiti, but he knew how it was supposed to go, how it would go. Kurtz was watching him closely.
I won't say all is forgiven for that foolish stunt you pulled this afternoon, that water's under the bridge, but you owe me one buck. I don't need ESP to know how you feel about what I'm telling you, and I'm not going to waste my breath telling you to grow up and face reality. All I can tell you is that I need you. You have to help me this one time.
The swimming eyes, the infirm twitch, barely perceptible at the corner of his mouth. It was easy to forget that Kurtz had blown a man's foot off not 10 minutes ago. Owen thought, if I help him do this, it doesn't matter if I actually pull a trigger or not. I'm as damned as the men who herded the Jews into the showers at Bergen-Belsen.
If we start at 11, we can be done at 11:30, Kurtz said. Noon at the very worst.
Then it's behind us. Except for the dreams.
Yes. Except for them.
Will you help me, Owen?
Owen nodded.
Yet he had come this far and wouldn't let go of the rope now, damned or not. At the very least, he could help make it merciful as any mass murder could be. Later, he would be struck by the lethal absurdity of this idea. But when you were with Kurtz, up close, and with his eyes holding yours, perspective was a joke. His madness was probably much more infectious than the Ripley in the end.
Good.
Kurtz slumped back in his rocker, looking relieved and drained. He took out his cigarettes again, peered in, then held the pack out.
Two left. Join me?
Owen shook his head.
Not this time, boss.
Then get on out of here. If necessary, shag ass over to the infirmary and get some Sonata.
I don't think I'll need that, Owen said.
He would, of course. He needed it already, but he wouldn't take it. Better to lie awake.
All right, then. Off you go.
Kurtz let him get as far as the door.
And Owen?
Owen turned back, zipping his parka. He could hear the wind out there now, building, starting to blow seriously as it had not during the relatively harmless Alberta Clipper that had come through that morning.
Thanks, Kurtz said.
One large and absurd tear overspilled his left eye and ran down his cheek. Kurtz seemed unaware. In that moment, Owen loved and pitied him, in spite of everything, which included knowing better.
Thank you, Buck.
Henry stood in the thickening snow, turned away from the worst of the wind and looking over his left shoulder at the Winnebago, waiting for Underhill to come back out. He was alone now. The storm had driven the rest of them back into the barn, where there was a heater. Rumors would already be growing tall in the warmth, Henry supposed. Better the rumors than the truth that was right in front of them. He scratched at his leg, realized what he was doing, and looked around, turning in a complete circle. No prisoners, no guards. Even in the thickening snow, the compound was almost as bright as noonday, and he could see well in every direction. For the time being, at least, he was alone. Henry rebent and untied the shirt knotted around the place where the turn signal stalk had cut his skin. He then spread the slit in his blue jeans. The men who had taken him into custody had made this same examination in the back of the truck where they had already stored 5 other refugees. On the way back to Goslin's, they had picked up 3 more. At that point, he had been clean. He wasn't clean now. A delicate thread of red lace grew down the scabbed center of the wound. If he hadn't known what he was looking for, he might have mistaken it for a fresh seep of blood. Virus, he thought.
Ah, fuck, good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are.
A flash of light winked at the top of his vision. Henry straightened and saw Underhill just pulling the door of the Winnebago shut. Quickly, Henry retied the shirt around the hole in his jeans and then approached the fence. A voice in his head asked what he'd do if he called to Underhill and the man just kept on going. That voice also wanted to know if Henry really intended to give Jonesy up.
He watched Underhill trudge toward him in the glare of the security lights, his head bent against the snow and the intensifying wind. The door closed. Kurtz sat looking at it, smoking and slowly rocking. How much of his pitch had Owen bought? Owen was bright. Owen was a survivor. Owen was not without idealism, and Kurtz thought Owen had bought it all, with hardly a single dicker. Because in the end, most people believed what they wanted to believe. John Dillinger had also been a survivor, the wiliest of the 30s desperados, but he had gone to the Biograph Theater with Anna Sage just the same. Manhattan Melodrama had been the show, and when it was over, the feds had shot Dillinger down in the alley beside the theater like the dog he was. Anna Sage had also believed what she wanted to believe, but they deported her ass back to Poland just the same. No one was going to leave Goslin's market tomorrow except for his picked cadre, the 12 men and 2 women who made up Imperial Valley. Owen Underhill would not be among them, although he could have been. Until Owen had put the Gray Boys on the common channel, Kurtz had been sure he would be. But things changed. So Buddha had said, and on that one at least the old chink heathen had spoken true. "You let me down, Buck," Kurtz said. He had lowered his mask to smoke, and it bobbed against his grizzled throat as he spoke. "You let me down." Kurtz had let Owen Underhill get away with letting him down once, but twice? Never, Kurtz said. Never in life. Chapter 14. Going South. Mr. Gray ran the snowmobile down into a ravine which held a small frozen creek. He drove north along this for the remaining mile to I-95. 200 or 300 yards from the lights of the army vehicles, there were only a few now moving slowly in the thickening snow, he stopped long enough to consult the part of Jonesy's mind that it, could get at. There were files and files of stuff that wouldn't fit into Jonesy's little office stronghold, and Mr. Gray found what he was looking for easily enough. There was no switch to turn off the Arctic Cat's headlight. Mr. Gray swung Jonesy's legs off the snowmobile, looked for a rock, picked it up with Jonesy's right hand, and smashed the headlight dark. Then he remounted and drove on. The Cat's fuel was almost gone, but that was all right. The vehicle had served its purpose. The pipe which carried the creek beneath the turnpike was big enough for the snowmobile, but not for the snowmobile and its rider. Mr. Gray dismounted again. Standing beside the snowmobile, he revved the throttle and sent the machine bumping and yawing into the pipe. It went no more than 10 feet before stopping, but that was far enough to keep it from being seen from the air if the snow lightened, allowing low-level recon. Mr. Gray set Jonesy to climbing up the turnpike embankment. He stopped just shy of the guardrails and lay down on his back. Here he was temporarily protected from the worst of the wind. The climb had released a last little cache of endorphins, and Jonesy felt his kidnapper sampling them, enjoying them the way Jonesy himself might have enjoyed a cocktail or a hot drink after watching a football game on a brisk October afternoon. He realized, with no surprise, that he hated Mr. Gray. Then Mr. Gray, as an entity, something that could actually be hated, was gone again, replaced by the cloud Jonesy had first experienced back in the cabin when the creature's head had exploded. It was going out as it had gone out in search of Emil Brodsky. It had needed Dog Brodsky because the information about how to get the snowmobile started hadn't been in Jonesy's files. Now it needed something else. A ride was the logical assumption. And what was left here? What was left guarding the office where the last shred of Jonesy cowered? Jonesy, who had been turned out of his own body like lint out of a pocket. The cloud, of course. The stuff Jonesy had breathed in. Stuff that should have killed him, but had, for some reason, not done so. The cloud couldn't think, not the way Mr. Gray could. The man of the house, who was now Mr. Gray instead of Mr. Jones, had departed, leaving the place under the control of the thermostats, the refrigerator, the stove, and, in case of trouble, the smoke detector and the burglar alarm, which automatically dialed the police. Still, with Mr. Gray gone, he might be able to get out of the office. Not to regain control. If he tried that, the red-black cloud would report him and Mr. Gray would return from his scouting expedition at once. Jonesy would almost certainly be seized before he could retreat to the safety of the Tracker Brothers' office, with its bulletin board and its dusty floor and its one dirt-crusted window in the world. Only there were four crescent-shaped clean patches in that dirt, weren't there? Patches where four boys had once leaned their foreheads, hoping to see the picture that was pinned to the bulletin board now. Tina Jean Schlossinger, with her skirt up. No, seizing control was far beyond his ability, and he'd better accept that, bitter as it was. But he might be able to get to his files. Was there any reason to risk it? Any advantage? There might be, if he knew what Mr. Gray wanted. Beyond a ride, that was, and speaking of that, a ride where? The answer was unexpected, because it came in Duddits's voice.
Ow! Eerie! Oh, wow!
South. Mr. Gray, wanna go south. Jonesy stepped back from his dirty window on the world. There wasn't much to be seen out there just now anyway, snow and dark and shadowy trees. This morning's snow had been the appetizer. Here was the main course. Mr. Gray wanna go south. How far? And why? What was the big picture? On these subjects, Duddits was silent. Jonesy turned and was surprised to see that the route map and the picture of the girl were no longer on the bulletin board. Where they had been were four color snapshots of four boys. Each had the same background, Derry Junior High, and the same caption beneath, School Days, 1978. Jonesy himself on the far left, face split in a trusting ear-to-ear grin that now broke his heart. Beeve next to him, the Beeve's grin revealing the missing tooth in front, victim of a skating fall which had been replaced by a false one a year or so later, before high school anyway. Pete, with his broad, olive-tinted face and his shamefully short hair, mandated by his father who said he hadn't fought in Korea so his kid could look like a hippie. And Henry, on the end. Henry in his thick glasses that made Jonesy think of Danny Dunn, boy detective, star of the mysteries Jonesy had read as a kid. Beaver, Pete, Henry. How he had loved them, and how unfairly sudden the severing of their long friendship had been. No, it wasn't a bit fair. All at once, the picture of Beaver Clarendon came alive, scaring the hell out of Jonesy. Beaver's eyes widened, and he spoke in a low voice. His head was off. Remember? It was laying in the ditch and his eyes were full of mud. What a fuckerow. I mean, Jesus Christ, bananas. Oh, my God, Jonesy thought as it came back to him. The one thing about that first hunting trip to Hole in the Wall that he had forgotten, or suppressed. Had all of them suppressed it? Maybe so. Probably so. Because over the years since, they had talked about everything in their childhoods, all those shared memories, except that one. His head was off. His eyes were full of mud. Something had happened to them then. Something that had to do with what was happening to him now. If only I knew what it was, Jonesy thought. If I only knew. Andy Janis had lost the other three trucks in his little squadron, had gotten ahead of them because they weren't used to driving and shit like this, and he was. He had grown up in northern Minnesota, and you better believe he was used to it. He was by himself in one of Chevrolet's finer army vehicles, a modified four-wheel drive pickup, and he had the four-wheel drive engaged tonight. His father hadn't raised any fools. Still, the turnpike was mostly clear. A couple of army plows had gone by an hour or so ago. He would be catching up to them soon, he guessed, and when he did, he would cut speed and fall in behind them like a good boy. And no more than 2 or 3 inches had piled up on the concrete since then. The real problem was the wind, which lifted the fluff and turned the road into a ghost. You had the reflectors to guide you, though. Keeping the reflectors in sight was the trick those other gomers didn't understand. Or maybe, with the convoy trucks and the Humvees, the headlights were set too high to pick the reflectors up properly. And when the wind really gusted, even the reflectors disappeared. The goddamn world went totally white and you had to take your foot off the go pedal until the air stilled again and just try to stay on course in the meantime. He would be all right. and if anything happened, he was in radio contact and more plows would be coming up behind, keeping the southbound barrel of the turnpike open all the way from Presque Isle to Millinocket. In the back of his truck were two triple-wrapped packages. In one were the bodies of two deer which had been killed by the Ripley. In the other, this Janice found moderately to seriously gruesome, was the body of a gray boy turning slowly to a kind of reddish-orange soup. Both were bound for the docks at Blue Base, which had been set up at a place called... Janice looked up at the driver's visor. There, held in place by a rubber band, was a piece of notepaper and a ballpoint pen. Scrawled on the paper was Goslin's STO. Take EX-16, turn L. He'd be there in an hour, maybe less. The docs would undoubtedly tell him they had all the animal samples they needed and the deer carcasses would be burned, but they might want the gray boy if the little fella hadn't turned entirely to mush. The cold might retard that process a little bit, but whether it did or didn't was really none of Andy Janice's never mind. His concern was to get there, turn over his samples, and then await debriefing from whoever was in charge of asking questions about the Q-Zone's northern and most quiet perimeter. While he was awaiting, he would grab some hot coffee and a great big plate of scrambled eggs. If the right someone was around, he might even be able to promote something to spike his coffee with. That would be good. Get a little buzz going, then just hunker down and pull over. Janice frowned, shook his head, scratched his ear as if something, a flea perhaps, had bitten him there. The goddamn wind gusted hard enough to shake the truck. The turnpike disappeared, and so did the reflectors. He was encased in total white again, and he had no doubt that this scared the ever-loving bejabbers out of the other guys, but not him. He was Mr. Minnesota Twins taking care of business. Just pull the old foot off the gas, and never mind the brake. When you were driving in a snowstorm, the brake was the best way he knew to turn a good ride bad. Just coast and wait for pull over. Huh? He looked at the radio, but there was nothing there. Just static and dim background chatter. Pull over. Ow, Janice cried, and grabbed at his head, which suddenly hurt like a motherfucker. The olive-green pickup swerved, skidded, then came back under control as his hands automatically steered into the skid. His foot was still off the gas, and the Chevy's speedometer needle unwound rapidly. The plows had made a narrow path down the center of the two southbound lanes. Now Janice steered into the thicker snow to the right of this path, the truck's wheels spuming up a haze of snow which the wind quickly whipped away. The guardrail reflectors were very bright, glaring in the dark like cat's eyes. "Pull over here!" Janice screamed with pain. From a great distance he heard himself shouting, "Okay, okay, I am! Just stop it! Quit yanking me!" Through watering eyes, he saw a dark form rear up on the far side of the guardrails not 50 feet ahead. As the headlights struck the shape fully, he saw it was a man wearing a parka. Andy Janice's hands no longer felt like his own. They felt like gloves with someone else's hands inside them. This was an odd and entirely unpleasant sensation. They turned the steering wheel farther to the left entirely without his help, and the pickup truck coasted to a stop in front of the man in the parka. This was his chance, with Mr. Gray's attention entirely diverted. Jonesy sensed that if he thought about it, he would lose his courage. So he didn't think. He simply acted, knocking back the bolt on the office door with the heel of his hand and yanking the door open. He had never been inside Tracker Brothers as a kid, and it had been gone since the big storm of 85. But he was pretty sure that it had never looked like what he saw now. Outside the dingy office was a room so vast Jonesy couldn't see the end of it. Overhead were endless acres of fluorescent bars. Beneath them, stacked in enormous columns, were millions of cardboard boxes. No, Jonesy thought, not millions, trillions. Yes, probably trillions was closer. Thousands of narrow aisles ran between them. He was standing at one edge of eternity's own warehouse, and the idea of finding anything in it was ludicrous. If he ventured away from the door into his office hideout, he would become lost in no time. Mr. Gray wouldn't need to bother with him. Jonesy would wander until he died, lost in a mind-boggling wasteland of stored boxes. That's not true. I could no more get lost in there than I could in my own bedroom. Nor will I have to hunt for what I want. This is my place. Welcome to your own head, big boy. The concept was so huge that it made him feel weak, only he couldn't afford to be weak right now, or to hesitate. Mr. Gray, everyone's favorite invader from the great beyond, wouldn't be occupied with the truck driver for long. If Jonesy meant to move some of these files to safety, he had to do it right now. The question was, which ones? Duddits, his mind whispered. This has something to do with Duddits. You know it does. He's been on your mind a lot lately. The other guys were thinking of him, too. Duddits is what held you and Henry and Pete and Beaver together. You've always known that. But now you know something else as well, don't you? Yes, he knew that his accident in March had been caused by thinking he'd seen Duddits once again being teased by Richie Granado and his friends. Only teased was a ludicrously inapt word for what had been going on behind Tracker Brothers that day, wasn't it? Tortured was the word. And when he'd seen that torture being reenacted, he had plunged into the street without looking, and...
His head was off!
Beaver suddenly said from the storeroom's overhead speakers, his voice so loud and sudden it made Jonesy cringe.
It was laying in the ditch and his eyes were full of mud. And sooner or later every murderer pays the price. What a fuckerow!
Richie's head. Richie Granado's head. And Jonesy had no time for this. He was a trespasser in his own head now, and he'd do well to move quickly. When he had first looked out at this enormous storeroom, all the boxes had been plain and unmarked. Now he saw that those at the head of the row closest to him were labeled in black grease pencil. Duddits. Was that surprising? Fortuitous? Not at all. They were his memories, after all, stored flat and neatly folded in each of the trillions of boxes, and when it came to memory, the healthy mind was able to access them pretty much at will. Need something to move them with, Jonesy thought. And when he looked around, he was not exactly amazed to see a bright red hand dolly. This was a magic place, a make-it-up-as-you-go-along place, and the most marvelous thing about it, Jonesy supposed, was that everybody had one. Moving quickly, he stacked some of the boxes marked Duddits on the dolly and ran them into the Tracker Brothers' office at a trot. He dumped them by tipping the dolly forward, spilling them across the floor. Untidy, but he could worry about the good housekeeping seal of approval later. He ran back out, feeling for Mr. Gray, but Mr. Gray was still with the truck driver. Janice, his name was. There was the cloud, but the cloud didn't sense him. It was as dumb as, well, as dumb as a fungus. Jonesy got the rest of the Duddits boxes and saw that the next stack had also acquired scribbled grease pencil labels. These latter said, dairy, and there were too many to take. The question was whether or not he needed to take any of them. He pondered this as he pushed the second load of memory boxes into the office. Of course the dairy boxes would be stacked near the Duddits boxes. Memory was both the act and the art of association. The question remained whether or not his dairy memories mattered. How was he supposed to know that when he didn't know what Mr. Gray wanted? But he did know. Mr. Gray wanna go south. Dairy was south. Jonesy sprinted back into the memory storehouse, pushing the dolly ahead of him. He'd take as many of the boxes marked dairy as he could and hope they were the right ones. He would also hope that he sensed Mr. Gray's return in time, because if he was caught out here, he would be swatted like a fly. Janice watched, horrified, as his left hand reached out and opened the driver's side door of his truck, letting in the cold, the snow, and the relentless wind.
"Don't hurt me anymore, mister. Please don't. You can have a ride if you want a ride. Just don't hurt me anymore. My head..."
Something suddenly rushed through Andy Janice's mind. It was like a whirlwind with eyes. He felt it prying into his current orders, his expected arrival time at Blue Base, and what he knew of Derry, which was nothing. His orders had taken him through Bangor. He'd never been to Derry in his life. He felt the whirlwind pull back and had one moment of delirious relief. I don't have what it needs. It's going to let me go. And then understood that the thing in his mind had no intention of letting him go. It needed the truck, for one thing. It needed to shut his mouth, for another. Janice put up a brief but bitterly energetic struggle. It was this unexpected resistance that allowed Jonesy time to remove at least one stack of the boxes marked Derry. Then Mr. Gray once more resumed his place at Janice's motor controls. Janice saw his hand shoot out and up to the driver's side visor. His hand gripped the ballpoint pen and yanked it free, snapping the rubber band which held it.
No! Janice shouted.
But it was too late. He caught a shiny, zipping glitter as his hand, which was gripping the ballpoint like a dagger, plunged the pen into his staring eye. There was a popping sound, and he jittered back and forth behind the wheel like a badly managed puppet, his fist digging the pen in deeper and deeper, up to the halfway mark, then to the three-quarter mark, his split eyeball now running down the side of his face like a freakish tear. The tip struck something that felt like thin gristle, bound up for a moment, then passed through into the meat of his brain.
You bastard, he thought. What are you... You bet...
There was a final, brilliant flash of light inside his head, and then everything went dark. Janice slumped forward over the wheel. The pickup's horn began to blow. Mr. Gray hadn't gotten much from Janice, mostly that unexpected struggle for control at the end, but one thing which came through clearly was that Janice wasn't on his own. The transport column, of which he had been a part, had strung out because of the storm, but they were all headed to the same place, which Janice had identified in his mind as both Blue Base and Goslin's. There was a man there that Janice had been afraid of, the man in charge, but Mr. Gray could not have cared less about Creepy Kurtz, the boss, Crazy Abe. Nor did he have to care, since he had no intention of going anywhere near Goslin's store. This place was different, and this species, although only semi-sentient, composed mostly of emotions, was different too. They fought. Mr. Gray had no idea why, but they did. Best to finish it quickly. And to that end, he had discovered an excellent delivery system. Using Jonesy's hands, Mr. Gray pulled Janice from behind the wheel and carried him to the guardrails. He threw the body over the side, not bothering to watch as it tumbled down the slope to the frozen stream bed. He went back to the truck, looked fixedly at the two plastic wrap bundles in the back, and nodded. The animal corpses were good for nothing. The other, though, that would be useful. It was rich with what he needed. He looked up suddenly, Jonesy's eyes widening in the blowing snow. The owner of this body was out of its hiding place. Vulnerable. Good, because that consciousness was starting to annoy him, a constant muttering, sometimes rising to a panicky squeal on the lower level of his thought process. Mr. Gray paused a moment longer, trying to make his mind blank, not wanting Jonesy to have the slightest warning. And then he pounced. He didn't know what he had expected, but not this. Not this dazzling white light. Jonesy was nearly caught out. Would have been caught out if not for the fluorescence with which he had lit his mental storeroom. This place might not actually exist, but it was real enough to him, and that made it real enough to Mr. Gray when Mr. Gray arrived. Jonesy, who was pushing the dolly filled with boxes marked Derry, saw Mr. Gray appear like magic at the head of a corridor of high-stacked cartons. It was the rudimentary humanoid that had been standing behind him at Hole in the Wall, the thing he had visited in the hospital. The dull black eyes were finally alive, hungry. It had crept up, caught him outside his office refuge, and it meant to have him. But then its bulge of a head recoiled, and before its three-fingered hand shielded its eyes, it had no lids, not even any lashes, Jonesy saw an expression on its gray sketch of a face that had to be bewilderment, maybe even pain. It had been out there in the snowy dark, disposing of the driver's body. It had come in here unprepared for the discount mart glare. He saw something else, too. The invader had borrowed its expression of surprise from the host. For a moment, Mr. DeGray was a horrible caricature of Jonesy himself. Its surprise gave Jonesy just enough time. Pushing the dolly ahead of him, almost without realizing it, and feeling like the imprisoned princess in some fucked-up fairy tale, he ran into the office. He sensed, rather than saw, Mr. Gray reaching out for him with his three-fingered hands. The gray skin was raw-looking, like very old uncooked meat, and slammed the office door just ahead of their clutch. He bumped the dolly with his bad hip as he spun around. He accepted that he was inside his own head, but all of this was nevertheless completely real, and just managed to run the bolt before Mr. Gray could turn the knob and force his way in. Jonesy engaged the thumb lock in the center of the doorknob for good measure. Had the thumb lock been there before, or had he added it? He couldn't remember. Jonesy stepped back, sweating, and this time ran his butt into the handle of the dolly. In front of him, the doorknob turned back and forth, back and forth. Mr. Gray was out there, in charge of the rest of his mind and his body as well, but he couldn't get in here, couldn't force the door, didn't have the heft to break it down, didn't have the wit to pick the lock. Why? How could that be? "Duddits," he whispered. "No bounce, no play." The doorknob rattled. "Let me in," Mr. Gray snarled. And to Jonesy, he didn't sound like an emissary from another galaxy, but like anyone who has been denied what he wants and is pissed off about it. Was that because he was interpreting Mr. Gray's behavior in terms which he, Jonesy, understood? Humanizing the alien? Translating him? "Let me in," Jonesy responded without thinking. "Not by the hair of my chinny chin chin," and thought, "To which you say, then I'll huff, and I'll puff, and I'll blow your house in." But Mr. Gray only rattled the knob harder than ever. He was not used to being balked in this manner, or in any manner, Jonesy guessed, and was very pissed. Janice's momentary resistance had startled him, but this was resistance on a whole other level. "Where are you?" Mr. Gray called angrily. "How can you be in there? Come out!" Jonesy didn't reply, only stood among the tumbled boxes, listening. He was almost positive Mr. Gray couldn't get in, but it would be just as well not to provoke him. And after a little more knob rattling, he sensed Mr. Gray leaving him. Jonesy went to the window, stepping over the tumbled boxes marked Duddits and Dairy to get there, and stared out into the snowy night. Mr. Gray climbed to Jonesy's body back behind the wheel of the truck, slammed the door, and pushed the accelerator. The truck bolted forward, then lost purchase. All four wheels spun, and the truck skidded into the guardrails with a jarring bang. "Fuck!" Mr. Gray cried, accessing Jonesy's profanity almost without being aware of it. "Jesus Christ, bananas, kiss my bend, a doodly fuck, bite my bag!" Then he stopped and accessed Jonesy's driving skills again. Jonesy had some information on driving and weather like this, but nowhere near as much as Janice had possessed. Janice was gone, however, his files erased. What Jonesy knew would have to do. The important thing was to get beyond what Janice had thought of as the Q-zone. Beyond the Q-zone, he would be safe. Janice had been clear about that. Jonesy's foot pressed down on the gas pedal again, much more gently this time. The truck started to move. Jonesy's hands steered the Chevrolet back into the fading path left by the plow. Under the dash, the radio crackled to life.
"Tubby One, this is Tubby Four. I got a rig off the road and turned over on the median. Do you copy?"
Mr. Gray consulted the files. What Jonesy knew about military communication was skimpy, mostly gleaned from books and something called the movies, but it might do. He took the mic, felt for the button Jonesy seemed to think would be on the side, found it, pushed it.
I copy, he said. Would Tubby 4 be able to tell that Tubby 1 was no longer Andy Janus? Based on Jonesy's files, Mr. Gray doubted it.
A bunch of us are going to get him up, see if we can get him back on the road. He's got the goddamn food, you copy?
Mr. Gray pushed the button.
Got the goddamn food, copy.
A longer pause, long enough for him to wonder if he'd said something wrong, stepped in some kind of a trap, and then the radio said,
We'll have to wait for the next bunch of plows, I guess. You might as well keep rolling, over.
Tubby 4 sounded disgusted. Jonesy's files suggested that might be because Janus, with his superior driving skills, had gotten too far ahead to help. All this was good. He would have kept moving in any case, but it was good to have Tubby 4's official sanction, if that's what it was. He checked Jonesy's files, which he now saw as Jonesy saw them, boxes in a vast room, and said,
Copy, Tubby 1, over and out.
And as an afterthought,
Have a nice night.
The white stuff was horrible. Treacherous. Nonetheless, Mr. Gray risked driving a little faster. As long as he was in the area controlled by Creepy Kurtz's armed force, he might be vulnerable. Once out of the net, however, he would be able to complete his business very quickly. What he needed had to do with a place called Derry, and when Mr. Gray went into the big storeroom again, he discovered an amazing thing. His unwilling host had either known that or sensed it, because it had been the Derry files Jonesy had been moving when Mr. Gray had returned and almost caught him. Mr. Gray searched the boxes that were left with sudden anxiety, and then relaxed. What he needed was still here. Lying on its side near the box which contained the most important information was another box, very small and very dusty. Written on the side in black pencil was the word Duddits. If there were other Duddits boxes, they had been removed. Only this one had been overlooked. More out of curiosity than anything else, his curiosity also borrowed from Jonesy's store of emotions, Mr. Gray opened it. Inside was a bright yellow container made of plastic. Outlandish figures capered on it, figures Jonesy's files identified as both cartoons and the Scooby-Doos. On one end was a sticker reading, I belong to Duddits Cavell, 19 Maple Lane, Derry, Maine. If the boy I belong to is lost, call. This was followed by numbers too faint and illegible to read, probably a communication code Jonesy no longer remembered. Mr. Gray tossed the yellow plastic container, probably meant for carrying food, aside. It could mean nothing. Although if that were really the case, why had Jonesy risked his existence getting the other Duddits boxes, as well as some of those marked Derry, to safety? Duddits equals childhood friend. Mr. Gray knew this from his initial encounter with Jonesy in the hospital. And if he had known what an annoyance Jonesy would turn out to be, he would have erased his host's consciousness right then. Neither the term childhood nor the term friend had any emotional resonance for Mr. Gray, but he understood what they meant. What he didn't understand was how Jonesy's childhood friend could have anything to do with what was happening tonight. One possibility occurred to him. His host had gone mad. Being turned out of his own body had driven him insane, and he'd simply taken the boxes closest to the door of his perplexing stronghold, assigning them, in his madness, an importance they did not actually have. Jonesy, Mr. Gray said, speaking the name with Jonesy's vocal cords. These creatures were mechanical geniuses. Of course they would have to be to survive in such a cold world, but their thought processes were odd and crippled. Rusty mentation sunk in corrosive pools of emotion. Their telepathic abilities were minus. The transient telepathy they were now experiencing, thanks to the virus and the Kim, flashlights as they called them, bewildered and frightened them. It was difficult for Mr. Gray to believe they hadn't murdered their entire species yet. Creatures incapable of real thought were maniacs. This was surely beyond argument. Meanwhile, no answer from the creature in that strange, impregnable room. Jonesy. Nothing. But Jonesy was listening. Mr. Gray was sure of it. There's no necessity for this suffering, Jonesy. See us for what we are. Not invaders, but saviors.
buddies. Mr. Gray considered the various boxes. For a creature that couldn't actually think much, Jonesy had an enormous amount of storage capacity. Question for another day, why would beings who thought so poorly have so much retrieval capability? Did it have to do with their overblown emotional makeup? And the emotions were disturbing. He found Jonesy's emotions very disturbing. Always there, always on call, and so much of them. War, famine, ethnic cleansing, killing for peace, massacring the heathen for Jesus, homosexual people beaten to death, bugs in bottles, the bottles sitting on top of missiles aimed at every city in the world. Come on, Jonesy, compared to type 4 anthrax, what's a little virus between friends? Jesus Christ, bananas, you'll all be dead in 50 years anyway. This is good. Relax and enjoy it. You made that guy stick a pin in his eye. Grumpy, but better than nothing. The wind gusted. The pickup skidded, and Mr. Gray rode with it, using Jonesy's skills. The visibility was almost nil. He had dropped to 20 miles an hour and might do well to pull over completely for a while once he cleared Kurtz's net. Meanwhile, he could chat with his host. Mr. Gray doubted that he could talk Jonesy out of his room, but chatting, at least, passed the time. I had to, buddy. I needed the truck. I'm the last one. And you never lose. Right, Mr. Gray agreed. But you've never had a situation like this, have you? You've never had someone you can't get at. Was Jonesy taunting him? Mr. Gray felt a ripple of anger. And then he said something Mr. Gray had already thought of himself. Maybe you should have killed me in the hospital, or was that only a dream? Mr. Gray, unsure what a dream was, didn't bother responding. Having this barricaded mutineer in what by now should have been Mr. Gray's mind and his alone was increasingly annoying. For one thing, he didn't like thinking of himself as Mr. Gray. That was not his concept of himself or the species mind of which he was a part. He did not even like to think of himself as he, for he was both sexes and neither. Yet now he was imprisoned by these concepts and would be as long as the core being of Jonesy remained unabsorbed. A terrible thought occurred to Mr. Gray. What if it was his concepts that had no meaning? He hated being in this position. Who is Duddits, Jonesy? No answer. Who is Richie? Why was he a shit? Why did you kill him? We didn't. A little tremble in the mental voice. Ah, that shot had gone home. And something interesting. Mr. Gray had meant you in the singular, but Jonesy had taken it in the plural. You did, though. Or you think you did. That's a lie. How silly of you to say so. I have the memories right here in one of your boxes. There's snow in the box. Snow and a moccasin. Brown suede. Come out and look. For one giddy second, he thought Jonesy might do just that. If he did, Mr. Gray would sweep him back to the hospital at once. Jonesy could see himself die on television, a happy ending to the movie they had been watching. And then, no more Mr. Gray. Just what Jonesy thought of as the cloud. Mr. Gray looked eagerly at the doorknob, willing it to turn. It didn't. Come out. Nothing. You killed Richie, you coward. You and your friends. You dreamed him to death. And although Mr. Gray didn't know what dreams were, he knew that was true, or that Jonesy believed it was. Nothing. Come out! Come out and... He searched Jonesy's memories. Many of them were in boxes called movies. Jonesy seemed to love movies above all things, and Mr. Gray plucked what he thought a particularly potent line from one of these. And fight like a man. Nothing. You bastard, Mr. Gray thought, once more dipping into the enticing pool of his host's emotions. You son of a bitch, you stubborn asshole. Kiss my bender, you stubborn asshole. Back in the days when Jonesy had been Jonesy, he had often expressed anger by slamming his fist down on something.
Mr. Gray did it now, bringing Jonesy's fist down in the center of the truck's wheel hard enough to honk the horn.
Tell me! Not about Richie, not about Duddits, about you. Something makes you different. I want to know what it is.
No answer.
It's in the crib. Is that it?
Still no answer, but Mr. Gray heard Jonesy's feet shuffle behind the door, and perhaps a low intake of breath. Mr. Gray smiled with Jonesy's mouth.
Talk to me, Jonesy. We'll play the game. We'll pass the time. Who was Richie besides number 19? Why were you angry with him? Because he was a tiger? A dairy tiger? What were they? Who's Duddits?
Nothing. The truck crept more slowly than ever through the storm, the headlights almost helpless against the swirling wall of white. Mr. Gray's voice was low, coaxing. You missed one of the Duddits boxes, buddy. Did you know that? There's a box inside the box, as it happens. It's yellow. There are Scooby-Doos on it. What are Scooby-Doos? They're not real people, are they? Are they movies? Are they televisions? Do you want the box? Come out, Jonesy. Come out, and I'll give you the box. Mr. Gray removed his foot from the gas pedal and let the truck coast slowly to the left, over into the thicker snow. Something was happening here, and he wanted to turn all his attention to it. Force had not dislodged Jonesy from his stronghold, but force wasn't the only way to win a battle or a war. The truck stood idling by the guardrails in what was now a full-fledged blizzard. Mr. Gray closed his eyes. Immediately, he was in Jonesy's brightly lit memory storehouse. Behind him were miles of stacked boxes, marching away under the fluorescent tubes. In front of him was the closed door, shabby and dirty, and for some reason very, very strong. Mr. Gray placed his three-fingered hands on it and began to speak in a low voice that was both intimate and urgent.
Who is Duddits? Why did you call him after you killed Richie? Let me in. We need to talk. Why did you take some of the dairy boxes? What did you not want me to see? It doesn't matter. I have what I need. Let me in, Jonesy. Better now than later.
It was going to work. He sensed Jonesy's blank eyes, could see Jonesy's hand moving toward the knob and the lock.
We always win, Mr. Gray said.
He sat behind the wheel with Jonesy's eyes closed, and in another universe, the wind screamed and rocked the truck on its springs.
Open the door, Jonesy. Open it now. Silence.
And then, from less than 3 inches away, and as surprising as a basinful of cold water dashed on warm skin, eat shit and die. Mr. Gray recoiled so violently that the back of Jonesy's head connected with the truck's rear window. The pain was sudden and shocking, a second unpleasant surprise. He slammed a fist down again, then the other, then the first once more. He was hammering on the wheel, the horn beating out a Morse code of rage. A largely emotionless creature, and part of a largely emotionless species, he had been hijacked by his host's emotional juices, not just dipping in them this time, but bathing. And again, he sensed this was only happening because Jonesy was still there, an unquiet tumor in what should have been a serene and focused consciousness. Mr. Gray hammered on the wheel, hating this emotional ejaculation, what Jonesy's mind identified as a tantrum, but loving it, too. Loving the sound of the horn when he hit it with Jonesy's fists. Loving the beat of Jonesy's blood in Jonesy's temples. Loving the way Jonesy's heart sped up and the sound of Jonesy's hoarse voice crying, you fuckhead, over and over and over. And even in the midst of this rage,
a cold part of him realized what the true danger was. They always came. They always made the worlds they visited over in their image. It was the way things had always been, and the way they were meant to be. But now, something's happening to me, Mr. Gray thought, aware, even as the thought came, that it was essentially a Jonesy thought. I'm starting to be human. The fact that the idea was not without its attractions filled Mr. Gray with horror. Jonesy came out of a doze where the only sound was the soothing, lulling rhythm of Mr. Gray's voice, and saw that his hands were resting on the locks of the office door, ready to turn the lower and draw the bolt on the upper. The son of a bitch was trying to hypnotize him, and doing a pretty good job of it. "We always win," said the voice on the other side of the door. It was soothing, which was nice after such a stressful day, but it was also vilely complacent. The usurper, who would not rest until he had it all, who took getting it all as a given. "Open the door, Jonesy. Open it now." For a moment, he almost did it. He was awake again, but he almost did it anyway. Then he remembered two sounds, the tenebrous creak of Pete's skull as the red stuff tightened on it, and the wet, squittering Janice's eye had made when the tip of the pen pierced it. Jonesy realized he hadn't been awake at all, not really, but now he was. Now he was. Dropping his hands away from the lock and putting his lips to the door, he said, "Eat shit and die," in his clearest voice. He felt Mr. Gray recoil. He even felt the pain when Mr. Gray thumped back against the window, and why not? They were his nerves, after all, not to mention his head. Few things in his life gave him so much pleasure as Mr. Gray's outraged surprise, and he vaguely realized what Mr. Gray already knew. The alien presence in his head was more human now. "If you could come back as a physical entity, would you still be Mr. Gray?" Jonesy wondered. He didn't think so. Mr. Pink, maybe, but not Mr. Gray. He didn't know if the guy would try his Monsieur Mesmer routine again, but Jonesy decided to take no chances. He turned and went to the office window, tripping over one of the boxes and stepping over the rest. Christ, but his hip hurt. It was crazy to feel such pain when you were imprisoned in your own head, which, Henry had once assured him, had no nerves anyway, at least not once you got into the old gray matter. But the pain was there all right. He had read that amputees sometimes felt horrible agonies and unscratchable itches in limbs that no longer existed. Probably this was the same deal. The window had returned to a tiresome view of the weedy, double-rutted driveway which had run alongside the Tracker Brothers Depot back in 1978. The sky was white and overcast. Apparently, when his window looked into the past, time was frozen at mid-afternoon. The only thing the view had to recommend it was that, as he stood here taking it in, Jonesy was as far from Mr. Gray as he could possibly get. He guessed that he could change the view if he really wanted to, could look out and see what Mr. Gray was currently seeing with the eyes of Gary Jones. He had no urge to do that, however. There was nothing to look at but the snowstorm, nothing to feel but Mr. Gray's stolen rage. "Think of something else," he told himself. "What?" "I don't know. Anything. Why not?" On the desk, the telephone rang. And that was odd on an Alice in Wonderland scale, because a few minutes ago, there had been no telephone in this room, and no desk for it to sit on. The litter of old used rubbers had disappeared. The floor was still dirty, but the dust on the tiles was gone. Apparently, there was some sort of janitor inside his head, a neatnik, who had decided Jonesy was going to be here for a while, and so the place ought to be at least tolerably clean. He found the concept awesome, the implications depressing. On the desk, the phone shrilled again. Jonesy picked up the receiver and said, "Hello?" Beaver's voice sent a sick and horrible chill down his back. A telephone call from a dead man. It was the stuff of the movies he liked. Had liked, anyway.
His head was off, Jonesy. It was laying in the ditch, and his eyes were full of mud.
There was a click, then dead silence. Jonesy hung the phone up and walked back to the window. The driveway was gone. Derry was gone. He was looking at hole in the wall under a pale, clear, early morning sky. The roof was black instead of green, which meant this was hole in the wall as it had been before 1982, when the four of them, then strapping high school boys, well, Henry had never been what you'd call strapping, had helped Beeve's dad put up the green shingles the camp still wore. Only Jonesy needed no such landmark to know what time it was. No more than he needed someone to tell him the green shingles were no more. Hole in the wall was no more. Henry had burned it to the ground. In a moment, the door would open, and Beaver would run out. It was 1978, the year all this had really started, and in a moment, Beaver would run out wearing only his boxer shorts and his many-zippered motorcycle jacket, the orange bandanas fluttering. It was 1978. They were young, and they had changed. No more same shit, different day. This was the day when they began to realize just how much they had changed. Jonesy stared out the window, fascinated. The door opened. Beaver Clarendon, age 14, ran out. Chapter 15, Henry and Owen. Henry watched Underhill trudge toward him in the glare of the security lights. Underhill's head was bent against the snow and the intensifying wind. Henry opened his mouth to call out, but before he could, he was overwhelmed, nearly flattened, by a sense of Jonesy. And then a memory came, blotting out Underhill and this brightly lit, snowy world completely. All at once, it was 1978 again. Not October, but November. And there was blood. Blood on cattails, broken glass in marshy water, and then the bang of the door. Henry awakes from a terrible, confused dream. Blood, broken glass, the rich smells of gasoline and burning rubber, to the sound of a banging door and a blast of cold air. He sits up and sees Pete sitting up beside him, Pete's hairless chest covered with goosebumps. Henry and Pete are on the floor in their sleeping bags because they lost the four-way toss. Beeve and Jonesy got the bed. Later there will be a third bedroom at Hole in the Wall, but now there are only two, and Lamar has one all to himself by the divine right of adulthood. Only now Jonesy is alone in the bed, also sitting up, also looking confused and frightened. Scooby-Ooby-Doo, where are you? Henry thinks for no appreciable reason as he gropes for his glasses on the windowsill. In his nose, he can still smell gas and burning tires. We got some work to do now. Crashed, Jonesy says thickly, and throws back the covers. His chest is bare, but like Henry and Pete, he wore his socks and long john bottoms to bed. Yeah, went in the water, Pete said, his face suggesting he doesn't have the slightest idea what he's talking about. Henry, you got his shoe. Moccasin, Henry says. But he hasn't any idea what he's talking about either. Nor wants to. Beeve, Jonesy says, and gets out of bed in a clumsy lunge. One of his stocking-clad feet comes down on Pete's hand. Ow! Pete cries. You stepped on me, you fucking goma! Watch where you... Shut up! Shut up! Henry says, grabbing Pete's shoulder and giving it a shake. Don't wake up Mr. Clarendon! Which would be easy, because the door of the boy's bedroom is open. So is the door on the far side of the big central room, the one to the outside. No wonder they're cold. There's a hell of a draft. Now that Henry has his eyes back on, that is how he thinks of it, he can see the dream catcher out there dancing in the cold November breeze coming in through the open door. Where's Duddits? Jonesy asks in a dazed, I'm still dreaming voice. Did he go out with Beaver? He's back in Derry, foolish, Henry says, getting up and pulling on his thermal undershirt. And he doesn't feel that Jonesy is foolish, not really. He also has a sense that Duddits was just here with them. It was the dream, he thinks. Duddits was in the dream. He was sitting on the bank. He was crying. He was sorry. He didn't mean to. If anyone meant to, it was us. And there is still crying. He can hear it coming in through the front door, carried on the breeze. It's not Duddits, though. It's the Beeve. They leave the room in a line, pulling on scraps of clothes as they go, not bothering with their shoes, which would take too long. One good thing, judging from the tin city of beer cans on the kitchen table, plus a suburb of same on the coffee table, it'll take more than a couple of open doors and some whispering kids to wake up Beaver's dad. The big granite doorstep is freezing under Henry's stockinged feet, cold in the deep, thoughtless way a death must be cold, but he barely notices. He sees the Beaver right away. He's at the foot of the maple tree with the deer stand in it, on his knees as if praying. His legs and feet are bare, Henry sees. He's wearing his motorcycle jacket, and tied up and down its arms, fluttering like pirate's finery, are the orange bandanas his father made his son wear when Beaver insisted on wearing such a damned, foolish, unhunterly thing in the woods. The outfit looks pretty funny, but there's nothing funny about that agonized face tilted up toward the maple's nearly bare branches. The Beeve's cheeks are streaming with tears. Henry breaks into a run. Pete and Jonesy follow suit, their breath puffing white in the chill morning air. The needle-strewn ground under Henry's feet is almost as hard and cold as the granite doorstep. He drops to his knees beside Beaver, scared and somehow awed by those tears. Because the Beeve isn't just misting up, like the hero of a movie who may be allowed to shed a manly drop or two when his dog or his girlfriend dies. Beeve is running like Niagara Falls. From his nose hang two ropes of clear, glistening snot. You never saw stuff like that in the movies. Gross, Pete says. Henry looks at him impatiently, but then he sees Pete isn't looking at Beaver, but past him, at a steaming puddle of vomit. In it are kernels of last night's corn. Lamar Clarendon believes passionately in the virtues of canned food when it comes to camp cooking, and strings of last night's fried chicken. Henry's stomach takes a big, unhappy lurch, and just as it starts to settle, Jonesy yarks. The sound is like a big liquid belch. The puke is brown. Gross! Pete almost screams it this time. Beaver doesn't seem to even notice.
Henry, he says.
His eyes, submerged between twin lenses of tears, are huge and spooky. They seem to peer past Henry's face and into the supposedly private rooms behind his forehead.
Beaver, it's okay. You had a bad dream.
Sure, a bad dream.
Jonesy's voice is thick, his throat still plated with puke. He tries to clear it with a thick, ratching noise that is somehow worse than what just came out of him, then bends over and spits. His hands are planted on the legs of his long handles, and his bare back is covered with bumps. Beaver takes no notice of Jonesy, nor of Pete, as Pete kneels down on his other side and puts a clumsy, tentative arm around Beaver's shoulders. Beaver continues to look only at Henry.
His head was off, Beaver whispers.
Jonesy also drops to his knees, and now all three of them are surrounding the Beaver, Henry and Pete to either side, Jonesy in front. There is vomit on Jonesy's chin. He reaches to wipe it away, but Beaver takes his hand before he can. The boys kneel beneath the maple, and suddenly they are all one. It is brief, this sense of union, but as vivid as their dream. It is the dream. But now they are all awake. The sensation is rational, and they cannot disbelieve. Now it is Jonesy the Beaver is looking at with his spooky swimming eyes, clutching Jonesy's hand.
It was laying in the ditch, and his eyes were full of mud.
Yeah, Jonesy whispers in an awed and shaky voice.
Oh, geez, it was. Said he'd see us again, remember? Pete asks. One at a time, or all together? He said that.
Henry hears these things from a great distance, because he's back in the dream, back at the scene of the accident. At the bottom of a trash-littered embankment where there is a soggy piece of marsh created by a blocked drainage culvert. He knows the place. It's on Route 7, the old Derry Newport Road. Lying overturned in the muck and the murk is a burning car. The air stinks of gas and burning tires. Duddits is crying. Duddits is sitting halfway down the trashy slope and holding his yellow Scooby-Doo lunchbox against his chest and crying his eyes out. A hand protrudes from one of the windows of the overturned car. It's slim, the nails painted candy apple red. The car's other two occupants have been thrown clear, one of them almost 30 damn feet. This one's face down, but Henry still recognizes him by the masses of soaked blonde hair. It's Duncan, the one who said you're not going to tell anyone anything because you'll be fucking dead. Only Duncan's the one who wound up dead. Something floats against Henry's shin. "Don't pick that up," Pete says urgently, but Henry does. It's a brown suede moccasin. He has just time to register this, and then Beaver and Jonesy shriek in terrible childish harmony. They are standing together, ankle-deep in the muck, both of them wearing their hunting clothes. Jonesy in his new bright orange parka, bought special from Sears for this trip, and Mrs. Jones, still tearfully, unpersuadably convinced that her son will be killed in the woods by a hunter's bullet cut down in his prime. Beaver, in his tattered motorcycle jacket. "What a lot of zippers," Duddy's mom had said admiringly, thus winning Beaver's love and admiration forever, with the orange bandanas tied up and down the arms. They aren't looking at the third body, the one lying just outside the driver's door, but Henry does, just for a moment, still holding the moccasin like a small waterlogged canoe in his hands, because something is terribly, fundamentally wrong with it. So wrong that for a moment he cannot tell what it might be. Then he realizes that there's nothing above the collar of the corpse's high school jacket. Beaver and Jonesy are screaming because they have seen what should have been above it. They have seen Richie Grenadeau's head lying face up, glaring at the sky from a blood-spattered stand of cattails. Henry knows it's Richie at once. Even though the swatch of tape no longer rides the bridge of his nose, there is no mistaking the guy who was trying to feed Duddits a piece of shit that day behind trackers. Duds is up there on the bank, crying and crying, that crying that gets into your head like a sinus headache, and if it goes on, it will drive Henry mad. He drops the mock and slogs around the back of the burning car to where Beaver and Jonesy stand with their arms around each other. "Beaver! Beave!" Henry shouts. But until he reaches out and gives Beaver a hard shake, Beaver just continues to stare at the severed head as if hypnotized. Finally, though, Beaver looks at him.
"His head's off," he says, as if this were not evident.
"Henry, his head's..."
"Never mind his head. Take care of Duddits. Make him stop that goddamn crying."
"Yeah," Pete says. He looks at Richie's head, that final dead glare, then looks away, mouth twitching.
"It's driving me fucking bug shit."
"Like chalk on a chalkboard," Jonesy mutters above his new orange parka. His skin is the color of old cheese.
"Make him stop, Beav."
He.
"Don't be a dweeb. Sing him the fucking song," Henry shouts.
He can feel mucky water oozing up between his toes.
"The lullaby. The goddamn lullaby."
For a moment, the Beave looks as though he still doesn't understand. But then, his eyes clear a little, and he says, "Oh." He goes slogging toward the embankment where Duddits sits, clutching his bright yellow lunchbox and howling as he did on the day they met him. Henry sees something that he barely has time to notice. There is blood caked around Duddits' nostrils, and there's a bandage on his left shoulder. Something is poking out of it, something that looks like white plastic.
"Duddits," the Beave says, climbing the embankment. "Duddy, honey, don't. Don't cry no more. Don't look at it no more. It's not for you to look at. It's so fucking gross."
At first, Duddits takes no notice, just goes on howling. Henry thinks he cried himself into a nosebleed, and that's the blood part. But what's that white thing sticking out of his shoulder? Jonesy has actually raised his hands to cover his ears. Pete has got one on top of his head as if to keep it from blowing off. Then Beaver takes Duddits in his arms, just as he did a few weeks earlier, and begins to sing in that high, clear voice that that you'd never think could come out of a scrub like the Beeve.
Baby's boat's a silver dream, sailing near and far.
And oh, miracle of blessed miracles, Duddits begins to quiet. Speaking from the corner of his mouth, Pete says, "Where are we, Henry? Where the fuck are we?"
"In a dream," Henry says. And all at once, the four of them are back under the maple tree at Hole in the Wall, kneeling together in their underwear and shivering in the cold.
"What?" Jonesy says. He pulls free to wipe at his mouth, and when the contact among them breaks, reality comes all the way back.
"What did you say, Henry?"
Henry feels the withdrawal of their minds, actually feels it, and he thinks, "We weren't meant to be like this, none of us. Sometimes being alone is better." Yes, alone. Alone with your thoughts.
"I had a bad dream," Beaver says.
He seems to be explaining this to himself rather than to the rest of them. Slowly, as if he were still dreaming, he unzips one of his jacket pockets, rummages around inside, and comes out with a Tootsie Pop. Instead of unwrapping it, Beaver puts the stick end in his mouth and begins to roll it back and forth, nipping and gnawing lightly.
"I dreamed that..."
"Never mind," Henry says, and pushes his glasses up on his nose. "We all know what you dreamed."
"We ought to. We were there," trembles on his lips, but he keeps it inside.
He's only 14, but wise enough to know that what is said cannot be unsaid. "When it's laid, it's played," they say when they're playing Rummy or Crazy Eights and someone makes a goofy-ass discard. If he says it, they'll have to deal with it. If he doesn't, then maybe, just maybe, it'll go away.
"I don't think it was your dream anyhow," Pete says. "I think it was Duddits's dream, and we all..."
"I don't give a shit what you think," Jonesy says, his voice so harsh that it startles them all. "It was a dream, and I'm going to forget it. We're all going to forget it, aren't we, Henry?"
Henry nods at once.
"Let's go back in," Pete says. He looks vastly relieved.
"My feet are free."
"One thing, though," Henry says. And they all look at him nervously, because when they need a leader, Henry is it. "And if you don't like the way I do it," he thinks resentfully, "someone else can do it, because this is no tit job, believe me."
"What?" Beaver asks, meaning, "what now?"
"When we go into Goslin's later on, someone's got to call Duds, in case he's upset."
No one replies to this, all of them awed to silence by the idea of calling their new retardo friend on the phone. It occurs to Henry that Duddits has likely never received a phone call in his life. This will be his first.
"You know, that's probably right," Pete agrees,
and then slaps his hand over his mouth like someone who has said something incriminating. Beaver, naked except for his dopey boxers and his even dopier jacket, is now shivering violently. The Tootsie Pop jitters at the end of its gnawed stick.
"Someday you'll choke on one of those things," Henry tells him.
"Yeah, that's what my mom says. Can we go in? I'm freezing."
They start back toward Hole in the Wall, where their friendship will end 23 years from this very day.
"Is Richie Granado really dead, do you think?" Beaver asks.
"I don't know and I don't care," Jonesy says. He looks at Henry. "We'll call Duddits, okay? I've got a phone and we can bill the charges to my number."
"Your own phone?" Pete says. "You lucky duck. Your folks spoil you fucking rotten, Gary."
Calling him Gary usually gets under his skin, but not this morning. Jonesy is too preoccupied.
"It was for my birthday, and I have to pay the long distance out of my allowance, so let's keep it short. And after that, this never happened. Never happened. You got that?"
And they all nod. Never happened. Never fucking happened. A gust of wind pushed Henry forward, almost into the electrified compound fence. He came back to himself, shaking off the memory like a heavy coat. It couldn't have come at a more inconvenient time. Of course, the time for some memories was never convenient. He had been waiting for Underhill, freezing his katukas off and waiting for his only chance to get out of here, and Underhill could have walked right by him while he stood daydreaming, leaving him up Shit Creek without a paddle. Only Underhill hadn't gone past. He was standing on the other side of the fence, hands in his pockets, looking at Henry. Snowflakes, landed on the transparent, bug-like bulb of the mask he wore, were melted by the warmth of his breath and ran down its surface like beaver's tears that day, Henry thought.
"You ought to go in the barn with the rest of them," Underhill said. "You'll turn into a snowman out here."
Henry's tongue was stuck to the roof of his mouth. His life quite literally depended on what he said to this man, and he could think of no way to get started. Couldn't even loosen his tongue. "And why bother?" the voice inside inquired, the voice of darkness, his old friend. "Really and truly, why bother? Why not just let them do what you were going to do to yourself anyway?" Because it wasn't just him anymore. Yet he still couldn't speak. Underhill stood where he was a moment longer, looking at him. Hands in pockets, hood thrown back to expose his short, dark blonde hair. Snow melting on the mask the soldiers wore and the detainees did not, because the detainees would not be needing them. For the detainees, as for the gray boys, there was a final solution. Henry struggled to speak and could not. Oh, God, it should have been Jonesy here, not him. Jonesy had always been better with his mouth. Underhill was going to walk away, leaving him with a lot of could-have-beens and might-have-beens. But Underhill stayed a moment longer.
"I'm not surprised you knew my name, Mr.
Henried? Is your name Henried? Devlin. It's my first name you're picking up. I'm Henry Devlin." Moving very carefully, Henry thrust his hand through the gap between a strand of barbed wire and one of electrified smooth wire. After Underhill did nothing but look at it expressionlessly for 5 seconds or so, Henry pulled his hand back to his part of the newly drawn world, feeling foolish and telling himself not to be such an idiot. It wasn't as if he'd been snubbed at a cocktail party. Once that was done, Underhill nodded pleasantly, as if they were at a cocktail party, instead of out here in a shrieking storm, illuminated by the newly installed security lights.
"You knew my name because the alien presence in Jefferson Tract has caused a low-level telepathic effect," Underhill smiled. "Sounds silly when you say it right out, doesn't it? But it's true. The effect is transient, harmless, and too shallow to be good for much except party games, and we're a little too busy tonight for those."
Henry's tongue came finally, blessedly, unstuck.
"You didn't come over here in a snowstorm because I knew your name," Henry said. "You came over because I knew your wife's name and your daughter's."
Underhill's smile didn't falter.
"Maybe I did," he said. "In any case, I think it's time we both got undercover and got some rest. It's been a long day."
Underhill began walking, but his way took him alongside the fence toward the other parked trailers and campers. Henry kept pace, although he had to work in order to do it. There was nearly a foot of snow on the ground now. It was drifting, and no one had tramped it down over here on the dead man's side.
"Mr. Underhill, Owen, stop a minute and listen to me. I've got something important to tell you."
Underhill kept walking along the path on his side of the fence, which was also the dead man's side. Did Underhill not know that? Head down against the wind, still wearing that faintly pleasant smile. And the awful thing, Henry knew, was that Underhill wanted to stop. It was just that Henry had not, so far, given him a reason to do so.
"Kurtz is crazy," Henry said.
He was still keeping pace, but he was panting audibly now, his exhausted legs screaming.
"But he's crazy like a fox."
Underhill kept walking, head down, and a little smile in place under the idiotic mask. If anything, he walked faster. Soon, Henry would have to run in order to keep up on his side of the fence, if running was still possible for him.
"You'll turn the machine guns on us," Henry panted. "Bodies go in the barn. Barn gets doused with gasoline, probably from old man Goslin's own pump. Why waste government issue? And then, ploof, up in smoke. 200, 400, it'll smell like a VFW pig roast in hell."
Underhill's smile was gone, and he walked faster still. Henry somehow found the strength to trot, gasping for air and fighting his way through knee-high snow dunes. The wind was keen against his throbbing face like a blade.
"But Owen, that's you, right? Owen, you remember that old rhyme? The one that goes, big fleas got little fleas to bite 'em, and so on, and so on, and so on, ad infinitum. That's here, and that's you, because Kurtz has got his own cadre. The man under him, I think his name is Johnson."
Underhill gave him a single, sharp look, then walked faster than ever. Henry somehow managed to keep up, but he didn't think he would be able to much longer. He had a stitch in his side. It was hot and getting hotter.
"That was supposed to be your job, the second part of the cleanup. Imperial Valley, that's the code name. Mean anything to you?"
Henry saw it didn't. Kurtz must never have told Underhill about the operation that would wipe out most of Blue Group. Imperial Valley meant exactly squat to Owen Underhill, and now, in addition to the stitch, Henry had what felt like an iron band around his chest, squeezing and squeezing.
"Stop! Jesus, Underhill, can't you?"
Underhill just kept striding along. Underhill wanted to keep his last few illusions. Who could blame him?
"Johnson, a few others. At least one's a woman. Could have been you, too, if you hadn't fucked up. You crossed the line, that's what he thinks. Not the first time, either. You did it before, at some place like Bossa Nova."
That earned Henry a sudden, sharp look. Progress? Maybe.
"In the end, I think even Johnson goes. Only Kurtz leaves here alive. The rest, nothing but a pile of ashes and bones. Your fucking telepathy doesn't tell you that, does it? Your little parlor trick mind-reading won't even fucking touch that."
The stitch in his side deepened and sank into his right armpit like a claw. At the same time, his feet slipped, and he went flailing, head first, into a snowdrift. His lungs tore furiously for air, and instead got a great gasp of powdery snow. Henry flailed to his knees, coughing and choking, and saw Underhill's back just disappearing into the wall of blowing snow. Not knowing what he was going to say, knowing only that it was his last chance, he screamed,
"You tried to piss on Mr. Rapallo's toothbrush, and when you couldn't do that, you broke that plate! Broke that plate and ran away, just like you're running away now, you fucking coward!"
Ahead of him, barely visible in the snow, Owen Underhill stopped. For a moment, he only stood there, his back to Henry, who knelt panting like a dog in the snow with melting, icy water running down his burning face. Henry was aware, in a way that was both distant and immediate, that the scratch on his leg where the virus was growing had begun to itch. At last, Underhill turned around and came back.
"How do you know about the Rapallos? The telepathy is fading. You shouldn't be able to get that deep."
"I know a lot," Henry said.
He got to his feet and then stood there, gasping and coughing.
"Because it runs deep in me. I'm different. My friends and I, we were all different. There were four of us. Two are dead. I'm in here. The fourth one. Mr. Underhill, the fourth one is your problem. Not me, not the people you've got in the barn or the ones you're still bringing in. Not your Blue Group or Kurtz's Imperial Valley cadre. Only him."
He struggled, not wanting to say the name. Jonesy was the one to whom he had been the closest. Beaver and Pete were great, but only Jonesy could run with him mind for mind, book for book, idea for idea. Only Jonesy also had the knack of dreaming outside the lines, as well as seeing the line. But Jonesy was gone, wasn't he? Henry was quite sure of that. He had been there, a tiny bit of him had been there, when the red-black cloud passed Henry. But by now, his old friend would have been eaten alive. His heart might still beat, and his eyes might still see, but the essential Jonesy was as dead as Pete and the Beeve. "Jonesy's your problem, Mr. Underhill. Gary Jones, of Brookline, Massachusetts. Kurtz is a problem, too. Underhill spoke too softly to be heard over the howling wind, but Henry heard him anyway, heard him in his mind. Underhill looked around. Henry followed the shift of his head and saw a few men running down the makeshift avenue between the campers and trailer boxes, no one close. Yet the entire area around the store and the barn was mercilessly bright, and even with the wind, he could hear revving engines, the stuttery roar of generators, and men yelling. Someone was giving orders through a bullhorn. The overall effect was eerie, as if the two of them had been trapped by the storm in a place filled with ghosts. The running men even looked like ghosts as they faded into the dancing sheets of snow. "We can't talk here," Underhill said. "Listen to me and don't make me repeat a single word, Buck." And in Henry's head, where there was now so much input that most of it was tangled into an incomprehensible stew, a thought from Owen Underhill's mind suddenly rose clear and plain. Buck. His word. I can't believe I used his word. "I'm listening," Henry said. The shed was on the far side of the compound, as far from the barn as it was possible to get, and although the outside was as brilliantly lit as the rest of this hellish concentration camp, the inside was dark and smelled sweetly of old hay. And something else, something a little more acrid. There were four men and a woman sitting with their backs against the shed's far wall. They were all dressed in orange hunting togs, and they were passing a joint. There were only two windows in the shed, one facing in toward the corral, the other facing out toward the perimeter fence and the woods beyond. The glass was dirty and cut the merciless white glare of the sodium arc lights a little. In the dimness, the faces of the pot-smoking prisoners looked gray, dead already.
"You want a hit?"
the one with the joint asked. He spoke in a strained, miserly voice, holding the smoke in, but he held the joint out willingly enough. It was a bomber, Henry saw, big as a panatella. "No, I want you all to get out of here." They looked at him, uncomprehending. The woman was married to the man currently holding the joint. The guy on her left was her brother-in-law. The other two were just along for the ride. "Go back to the barn," Henry said.
"No way," one of the other men said. "Too crowded in there. We prefer to be more exclusive. And since we were here first, I suggest that if you don't want to be sociable, you should be the one to..."
"I've got it," Henry said. He put a hand on the T-shirt knotted around his leg.
"Virus. What they call Ripley. Some of you may have it.
I think you do, Charles." He pointed at the fifth man, burly in his parka and balding.
"No," Charles cried.
But the others were already scrambling away from him. The one with the Cambodian cigar, his name was Darren Childs, and he was from Newton, Massachusetts, being careful to hold on to his smoke.
"Yeah, you do," Henry said. "Major league."
"So do you, Mona."
"Mona?"
"No, Marcia. It's Marcia."
"I don't," she said.
She got up, pressing her back against the shed wall and looking at Henry with large, terrified eyes. Doe's eyes. Soon all the does up here would be dead, and Marcia would be dead as well. Henry hoped she could not see that thought in his mind.
"I'm clean, mister. We're all clean in here except you."
She looked at her husband, who was not big, but bigger than Henry. They all were, actually. Not taller, maybe, but bigger.
"Throw him out, Dare."
"There are two types of Ripley," Henry said, stating as fact what he only believed. But the more he thought about it, the more sense it made. "Call them Ripley Prime and Ripley Secondary. I'm pretty sure that if you don't get a hot dose in something you ate or inhaled or something that went live into an open wound, you can get better. You can beat it." Now they were all looking at him with those big doe eyes, and Henry felt a moment of surpassing despair. Why couldn't he just have had a nice, quiet suicide? "I've got Ripley Prime," he said. He unknotted the T-shirt. None of them would do more than glance at the rip in Henry's snow-powdered jeans, but Henry took a good, big look for all of them. The wound made by the turn signal stalk had now filled up with virus. Some of the strands were 3 inches long, their tips wavering like kelp in a tidal current. He could feel the roots of the stuff working in steadily, deeper and deeper itching and foaming and fizzing. Trying to think. That was the worst of it. It was trying to think. Now they were moving toward the shed door, and Henry expected them to bolt as soon as they caught a clear whiff of the cold air. Instead, they paused.
"Mister, can you help us?" Marcia asked in a trembling child's voice.
Darren, her husband, put his arm around her.
"I don't know," Henry said. "Probably not, but maybe."
"Go on now. I'll be out of here in half an hour, maybe less, but probably it's best if you stay in the barn with the others."
"Why?" asked Darren Childs from Newton.
And Henry, who had only a ghost of an idea, nothing resembling a plan, said, "I don't know. I just think it is." They went out, leaving Henry in possession of the shed. Beneath the window facing the perimeter fence was an ancient bale of hay. Darren Childs had been sitting on it when Henry came in, as the one with the dope Childs had rated the most comfortable seat, and now Henry took his place. He sat with his hands on his knees, feeling immediately sleepy in spite of the voices tumbling around in his head and the deep, spreading itch in his left leg. It was starting in his mouth as well, where he had lost one of his teeth. He heard Underhill coming before Underhill actually spoke from outside the window, heard the approach of his mind.
"I'm in the lee of the wind and mostly in the shadow of the building," Underhill said. "I'm having a smoke. If someone comes along, you're not in there."
"Okay. Lie to me, I'll walk away, and you'll never in your short life speak to me again, out loud or otherwise."
"Okay. How did you get rid of the people in there?"
"Why?"
Henry would have said he was too tired to be angry, but that seemed not to be the case.
"Was it some kind of a goddamn test?"
"Don't be a jerk."
"I told them I've got Ripley Prime, which is the truth. They scattered in a hurry."
Henry paused.
"You've got it too, don't you?"
"What makes you think so?"
Henry could detect no strain in Underhill's voice, and as a psychiatrist, he was familiar with the signs. Whatever else Underhill might be, Henry had an idea he was a man with a tremendously cool head, and that was a step in the right direction. Also, he thought, it can't hurt if he understands he really has nothing to lose. "It's around your fingernails, isn't it? And a little in one ear? You'd wow 'em in Vegas, buddy." Henry saw Underhill's hand go up with a cigarette between the gloved fingers. He guessed the wind would end up smoking most of that one. "You get primary direct from the source. I'm pretty sure secondary comes from touching something that's growing it. Tree, moss, deer, dog, another person. You catch that kind like you catch poison ivy. This isn't anything your own medical technicians don't know. For all I can tell, I got the information from them. My head's like a goddamn satellite dish with everything beaming in on free preview and nothing blocked out. I can't tell where half of this stuff's coming from, and it doesn't matter. Now here's some stuff your med techs don't know. The grays call the red growth virus, a word that means the stuff of life. Under some circumstances, the prime version of it can grow the implants."
"The shit weasels, you mean?"
"Shit weasels, that's good. I like that. They spring from the virus, then reproduce by laying eggs. They spread, lay more eggs, spread again. That's the way it's supposed to work, anyway. Here, most of the eggs go dead. I have no idea if it's the cold weather, the atmosphere, or something else, but in our environment on the hill, it's all about the virus. It's all they've got that works. The stuff of life."
"Uh-huh,
but listen. The Greys are having big problems here, which is probably why they hung around so long, half a century, before making their move. The weasels, for instance. They're supposed to be saprophytes. Do you know what that means?"
"Henry, that's you, right, Henry? Henry, does this have any bearing on our present?"
"It has plenty of bearing on our present situation, and unless you want to own a large part of the responsibility for the end of all life on spaceship Earth, except for a lot of interstellar kudzu, that is, I advise you to shut up and listen."
A pause, then, "I'm listening."
"Saprophytes are beneficial parasites. We have them living in our guts, and we deliberately swallow more in some dairy products. Sweet acidophilus milk, for instance, and yogurt. We give the bugs a place to live, and they give us something in return. In the case of dairy bacteria, improved digestion. The weasels, under normal circumstances, normal on some other world, I guess, where the ecology differs in ways I can't even guess at, grow to a size maybe no bigger than the bowl of a teaspoon. I think that in females they may interfere with reproduction, but they don't kill. Not normally. They just live in the bowel. We give them food. They give us telepathy. That's supposed to be the trade. Only they also turn us into televisions. We are Gray Boy TV. And you know all this because you have one living inside you? There was no revulsion in Underhill's voice, but Henry felt it clearly in the man's mind, pulsing like a tentacle. One of the quote-unquote normal weasels? No. At least, he thought, I don't think so. Then how do you know what you know? Or are you maybe just making it up as you go along, trying to write yourself a pass out of here? How I know is the least important thing of all, Owen. But you know I'm not lying. You can read me. I know you think you're not lying. How much more of this mind-reading shit can I expect to get? I don't know. More if the virus spreads, probably, but not in my league. Because you're different. Skepticism, both in Underhill's voice and in Underhill's thoughts. Pal, I didn't know how different until today. But never mind that for a minute. For now, I just want you to understand that the Grays are in a shitpull here. For maybe the first time in their history, they're in an actual battle for control. First, because when they get inside people, the weasels aren't saprophytic, but violently parasitic. They don't stop eating, and they don't stop growing. They're cancer, Underhill. Second, the virus. It grows well on other worlds, but poorly on ours, at least so far. The scientists and the medical experts who are running this rodeo think the cold is slowing it down, but I don't think that's it, or not all of it. I can't be positive because they don't know, but whoa. There was a brief cupped flame as Underhill lit another cigarette for the wind to smoke. You're not talking about the medical guys, are you? No. You think you're in touch with the Gray Boys, telepathically in touch. I think with one of them, through a link. This Jonesy you spoke of. Owen, I don't know. Not for sure. The point is, they're losing. Me, you, the men who went out there to the Blue Boy with you today, we might not be around to celebrate Christmas. I won't kid you about that. We got high, concentrated doses. But I've got it all right, Underhill said. Edwards, too. It showed up on him like magic. But even if it really takes hold on you, I don't think you can spread it very far. It's just not that catchable. There are people in that barn who will never get it, no matter how many virus-infected people they mingle with. And the people who do catch it, like a cold, come down with the virus secondary, or Ripley, if you like that better. Let's stick to virus. Okay. They might be able to pass it on to a few people who would have a very weak version we could call Virus 3. It might even be communicable beyond that. But I think once you've got to Virus 4, you'd need a microscope or a blood test to pick it up. Then, it's gone. Here's the instant replay. So pay attention. Point 1. The Grays, probably no more than delivery systems for the virus, are gone already. The ones the environment didn't kill, like the microbes finally killed the Martians in War of the Worlds, were wiped out by your gunships. All but one, that is. The one? Yeah, must be. That I got my information from. And, in a physical sense, he's gone too. Point 2. The weasels don't work. Like all cancers, they ultimately eat themselves to death. The weasels that escape from the lower intestine or the bowel quickly die in an environment they find hostile. Point 3. The virus doesn't work either. Not very well. But given a chance, given time to hide and grow, it could mutate. Learn to fit in. Maybe to rule. We're going to wipe it out, Underhill said. We're going to turn the entire Jefferson tract into a burn scar. Henry could have screamed with frustration, and some of that must have gotten through. There was a thud as Underhill jerked, striking the flimsy shed wall with his back. What you do up here doesn't matter, Henry said. The people you've got interned can't spread it. The weasels can't spread it, and the virus can't spread itself.
If your guys folded their tents and just walked away right now, the environment would take care of itself and erase all this nonsense like a bad equation. I think the Greys showed up the way they did because they just can't fucking believe it. I think it was a suicide mission with some Grey version of your Mr. Kurtz in charge. They simply cannot conceptualize failure. We always win, they think. How do you then, at the last minute on the hill, maybe at the last second, one of them found a man who was remarkably different from all the others with whom your Greys, the weasels, and the virus had come in contact. He's your Typhoid Mary, and he's already out of the Q zone, rendering anything you do here meaningless. Gary Jones. Jonesy. Right. What makes him different? Little as he wanted to go into this part of it, Henry realized he had to give Underhill something. He and I, and our two other friends, the ones who are dead, once knew someone who was very different. A natural telepath no virus needed. He did something to us. If we'd gotten to know him when we were a little older, I don't think that would have been possible. But we met him when we were particularly vulnerable, I suppose you'd say, to what he had. And then, years later, something else happened to Jonesy, something that had nothing to do with this remarkable boy. But that wasn't the truth, Henry suspected. Although Jonesy had been hit and almost killed in Cambridge, and Duddits had never, to Henry's knowledge, been south of Derry in his life, Duds had somehow been a part of Jonesy's final crucial change. A part of that, too. He knew it. And I'm supposed to... what, just believe all this? Swallow it like cough syrup? In the sweet-smelling darkness of the shed, Henry's lips spread in a humorless grin. Owen, he said, you do believe it. I'm a telepath, remember? The baddest one in the jungle. The question, though... the question is... Henry asked the question with his mind. Standing outside the compound fence by the back wall of the old storage shed, freezing his balls off, filter mask pulled down around his neck so he could smoke a series of cigarettes he did not want. He'd gotten a fresh pack in the PX. Owen would have said he never felt less like laughing in his life. But when the man in the shed responded to his eminently reasonable question with such impatient directness, "You do believe it. I'm a telepath, remember?" a laugh was surprised out of him nevertheless. Kurtz had said that if the telepathy became permanent and were to spread, society as they knew it would fall down. Owen had grasped the concept, but now he understood it on a gut level, too. The question, though, the question is, what are we going to do about it? Tired as he was, Owen could see only one answer to that question. We have to go after Jones, I suppose. Will it do any good? Do we have time? I think we might. Just. Owen tried to read what was behind Henry's response with his own lesser powers, and could not. Yet he was positive that most of what the man had told him was true. Either that or he believes it's true, Owen thought. God knows I want to believe it's true. Any excuse to get out of here before the butchery starts. No, Henry said, and for the first time Owen thought he sounded upset, not entirely sure of himself. No butchery. Kurtz isn't going to kill somewhere between 200 and 800 people. People who ultimately can't influence this business one way or the other. They're just... Christ, they're just innocent bystanders. Owen wasn't entirely surprised to find himself rather enjoying his new friend's discomfort. God knew Henry had discomfited him. What do you suggest, bearing in mind that you yourself said that only your pal Jonesy matters? Yes, but... floundering. Henry's mental voice was a little surer, but only a little. I didn't mean we'd walk away and let them die. We won't be walking anywhere, Owen said. We'll be running like a couple of rats in a corn crib. He dropped his third cigarette after a final token puff and watched the wind carry it away. Beyond the shed, curtains of snow rippled across the empty corral, building up huge drifts against the side of the barn.
Trying to go anywhere in this would be madness. It'll have to be a snowcat, at least to start with, Owen thought. By midnight, even a four-wheel drive might not be much good, not in this. Kill Kurtz, Henry said. That's the answer. It'll make it easier for us to get away with no one to give orders, and it'll put the biological cleansing on hold. Owen laughed dryly. You make it sound so easy, he said. 00 Underhill, license to kill. He lit a fourth cigarette, cupping his hands around the lighter and the end of the smoke. In spite of his gloves, his fingers were numb. We better come to some conclusions pretty quick, he thought, before I freeze to death. What's the big deal about it? Henry asked. But he knew what the big deal was, all right. Owen could sense and half hear him trying not to see it, not wanting things to be worse than they already were. Just walk in there and pop him. Wouldn't work. Owen sent Henry a brief image. Freddie Johnson and other members of the so-called Imperial Valley cadre keeping an eye on Kurtz's Winnebago. Also, he's got the place wired for sound. If anything happens, the hard boys come running. Maybe I could get him. Probably not, because he covers himself as thoroughly as any Colombian cocaine jefe, especially when he's on active duty, but maybe. I like to think I'm not bad myself, but it would be a suicide mission. If he's recruited Freddie Johnson, then he's probably got Cade Gallagher and Marvel Richardson, Carl Friedman, Jocelyn McAvoy. Tough boys and tough girls, Henry. I kill Kurtz, they kill me. The brass running this show from under Cheyenne Mountain send out a new cleaner, some Kurtz clone that'll pick up where Kurtz left off. Or maybe they just elect Kate to the job. God knows she's crazy enough. The people in the barn might get 12 additional hours to stew in their own juices, but in the end, they'll still burn. The only difference is that instead of getting a chance to go charging gaily through the snowstorm with me, handsome, you'll burn with the rest of them. Your pal, meanwhile, this guy Jonesy, he'll be off to where? That's something it might be prudent for me to keep to myself for the time being. Owen nonetheless probed for it with such telepathy as he possessed. For a moment, he caught a blurred and perplexing vision. A tall, white building in the snow, cylindrical, like a barn silo. And then it was gone, replaced by the image of a white horse that looked almost like a unicorn running past a sign. On the sign were red letters reading, Banbury Cross, under a pointing arrow. He grunted in amusement and exasperation. You're jamming me. You can think of it that way, or you can think of it as teaching you a technique you better learn if you'd like to keep our conversation a secret. Uh-huh. Owen wasn't entirely displeased with what had just happened. For one thing, a jamming technique would be a very good thing to have. For another, Henry did know where his infected friend, call him Typhoid Jonesy, was going. Owen had seen a brief picture of it in Henry's head. Henry, I want you to listen to me now, all right? Here's the simplest, safest thing we can do, you and I. First, if time isn't an utterly crucial factor, we both need to get some sleep. I can buy that. I'm next door to dead. Then around 3 o'clock, I can start to move and shake. This installation is going to be on high alert till the time when there isn't an installation here any longer. But if Big Brother's eyeball ever glazes over a little, it's apt to be between 4 and 6 a.m. I'll make a diversion, and I can short out the fence. That's the easiest part, actually. I can be here with a snowcat 5 minutes after the shit hits the fan. Telepathy had certain shorthand advantages to verbal communication, Owen was discovering. He sent Henry the image of a burning MH-6 Little Bird helicopter and soldiers running toward it even as he continued to speak. And off we go. Leaving Kurtz with a barn full of innocent civilians he plans to turn into crispy critters? Not to mention Blue Group. What's that, a couple of 300 more? Owen, who had been full-time military since the age of 19 and one of Kurtz's eraser heads for the last 8 years, sent 2 hard words along the mental conduit the two of them had established. Acceptable losses. Behind the dirty glass, the vague shape that was Henry Devlin stirred, then stood. No, he sent back. No? What do you mean, no? No, that's what I mean. Do you have a better idea? and Owen realized, to his extreme horror, that Henry thought he did. Fragments of that idea, it would be far too generous to call it a plan, shot through Owen's mind like the brightly fragmented tail of a comet. It took his breath away. The cigarette dropped unnoticed from between his fingers and zipped away on the wind.
You're nuts.
No, I'm not. We need a diversion in order to get away. You already know that. This is a diversion. They'll be killed anyway. Some will. Maybe even most of them. But it's a chance. What chance will they have in a burning barn?
Out loud, Henry said.
And there's Kurtz. If he's got a couple of hundred escapees to worry about, most of whom would be happy to tell the first reporters they came across that the panic-stricken U.S. government had sanctioned a My Lai massacre right here on American soil, he's going to be a lot less concerned about us.
You don't know Abe Kurtz, Owen thought. You don't know about the Kurtz line.
Of course, neither had he, not really, until today. Yet Henry's proposal made a lunatic kind of sense, and it contained at least a measure of atonement. As this endless November 14th marched toward midnight, and as odds of living until the end of the week grew longer, Owen was not surprised to find that the idea of atonement had its attractions.
Henry.
Yes, Owen, I'm here.
I've always felt badly about what I did in the Rapallo's house that day.
I know.
And yet I've done it again and again. How fucked up is that?
Henry, an excellent psychiatrist even after his thoughts had turned to suicide, said nothing.
Fucked up was normal human behavior. Sad but true.
All right, Owen said at last. You can buy the house, but I'm going to furnish it.
Deal?
Deal, Henry replied at once.
Can you really teach me that jamming technique? Because I think I may need it.
I'm pretty sure I can.
All right. Listen.
Owen talked for the next 3 minutes, sometimes out loud, sometimes mind to mind. The two men had reached a point where they no longer differentiated between the modes of communication. Thoughts and words had become one.
Chapter 16. Derry.
It's hot in Goslin's. God, it's so hot. The sweat pops out on Jonesy's face almost immediately, and by the time the four of them get to the payphone, which is near the wood stove, wouldn't you know it, it's rolling down his cheeks and his armpits feel like jungle growth after a heavy rain. Not that he has all that much growth there yet, not at 14. Don't you wish, as Pete likes to say.
So it's hot, and he's still partly in the grip of the dream, which hasn't faded the way bad dreams usually do. He can still smell gasoline and burning rubber. He can still see Henry holding that moccasin and the head. He can still see Richie Grenadeau's awful, severed head. And then the operator makes things worse by being a bitch. When Jonesy gives her the Cavell's number, which they call frequently to ask if they can come over, Roberta and Alfie always say yes, but it is only polite to ask permission. They have all been taught that at home. The operator asks, "Do your parents know you're calling long distance?" The words come out not in a Yankee drawl, but in the slightly Frenchified tones of someone who grew up in this part of the world, where Le Tourneau and Bissonnette are more common than Smith or Jones. The tightwad French, Pete's dad calls them, and now he's got one on the telephone, God help him.
They let me make toll calls if I pay the charges, Jonesy says.
And boy, he should have known that he would end up being the one to actually make it. He takes down the zipper of his jacket.
God, but it's boiling in here.
How those old geezers can sit around the stove like they're doing is more than Jonesy can understand. His own friends are pressing close around him, which is probably understandable. They want to know how things go, but still, Jonesy wishes they would step back a little. Having them so close makes him feel even hotter.
And if I were to call them, mon fille, your mère et père, they say the same?
Sure, Jonesy says. Sweat runs into one of his eyes, stinging, and he wipes it away like a tear.
My father's at work, but my mom should be home. 949-6658. Only I wish you'd make it quick, because...
I'll just ring on your party, she says, sounding disappointed. Jonesy slips out of his coat, switching the phone from one ear to the other in order to accomplish this,
and lets it puddle around his feet. The others are still wearing theirs. Beeve, in fact, hasn't even unzipped his Fonzie jacket. How they can stand it is beyond Jonesy. Even the smells are getting to him. Mustard oil and beans and floor oil and coffee and brine from the pickle barrel. Usually he likes the smells in Goslin's, but today they make Jonesy feel like blowing chunks. Connections click in his ear. So slow. His friends pushing in too close to the payphone on the back wall, crowding him. Two or three aisles over, Lamar is looking fixedly at the cereal shelf and rubbing his forehead like a man with a severe headache. Considering how much beer he put away last night, Jonesy thinks a headache would be natural. He's coming down with a headache himself, one that beer has nothing to do with. It's just so gosh damn hot in it. He straightens up a little. Ringing, he says to his friends, and immediately wishes he'd kept his mouth shut because they lean in closer than ever. Pete's breath is fucking awful, and Jonesy thinks, what do you do, Petesky? Brush them once a year, whether they need it or not? The phone is picked up on the third ring. Yes, hello. It's Roberta, but sounding distracted and upset rather than cheery as she usually does. Not that it's very hard to figure out why. In the background, he can hear Duddits bawling. Jonesy knows that Alfie and Roberta don't feel that crying the way Jonesy and his friends do. They are grown-ups. But they are also his parents. They feel some of it, and he doubts if this has exactly been Mrs. Cavell's favorite morning. Christ, how can it be so hot in here? What did they load that fucking wood stove up with this morning anyway, plutonium? Come on, who is it? Impatient, which is also completely unlike Mrs. Cavell. If being the mother of a special person like Duddits teaches you anything, she has told the boys on many occasions, it's patience. Not this morning, though. This morning, she sounds almost pissed off, which is unthinkable. If you're selling something, I can't talk to you. I'm busy right now. And Duddits in the background, trumpeting and wailing. You're busy all right, Jonesy thinks. He's been going on like that since dawn, and by now you must be just about out of your sneaker. Henry throws an elbow into Jonesy's side and flicks a hand at him. Go on, hurry up. And although it hurts, the elbow is still a good thing. If she hangs up on him, Jonesy will have to deal with that bitch of an operator again. Miss Cavell? Roberta? It's me, Jonesy. Jonesy. He senses her deep relief. She has wanted so badly for Duddy's friends to call that she half believes she is imagining this. Is it really you? Yeah, he said. Me and the other guys? He holds out the telephone. Hi, Mrs. Cavell, Henry says. Hey, what's up, is Pete's contribution. Hi, beautiful, Beaver says with a goony grin. He has been more or less in love with Roberta from the day they met her. Lamar Clarendon looks over at the sound of his son's voice, winces, then goes back to his contemplation of the Cheerios and shredded wheat. Go right ahead, Lamar told the Beeve when Beaver said they wanted to call Duddits. Dunno why you'd want to talk to that meringue head, but it's your buffalo nickel. When Jonesy puts the phone back to his ear, Roberta Cavell is saying, get back to Derry. I thought you were hunting up in Kineo or someplace. We're still up here, Jonesy says. He looks around at his friends and is astounded to see they are hardly sweating at all. A slight sheen on Henry's forehead, a few beads on Pete's upper lip, and that's all. Totally Weirdsville. We just thought, that we better call. You knew. Her voice was flat, not unfriendly, but unquestioning. He pulls at his flannel shirt, fanning it against his chest. Yeah. There are 1,000 questions most people would ask at this point, probably starting with, how did you know, or what in God's name is wrong with him. But Roberta isn't most people, and she has already had the best part of a month to see how they are with her son. What she says is, hold on, Jonesy, I'll get him. Jonesy waits. Far off, he can still hear Duddits wailing and Roberta, softer, talking to him, cajoling him to the phone, using what are now magic words in the Cavell household. Jonesy, Beaver, Pete, Henry. The blatting moves closer, and even over the phone, Jonesy can feel it working its way into his head, a blunt knife that digs and gouges instead of cutting. Youch! Duditz's crying makes Henry's elbow seem like a love tap. Meanwhile, the old jungle juice is rolling down his neck in rivers. His eyes fix on the two signs above the phone. "Please limit all calls to 5 mins," reads one. "Profanity not tolerated," reads the other. Beneath this, someone has gouged "Who the fuck says so?" Then Duditz is on, those awful, bellowing cries right there in his ear. Jonesy winces against them, but in spite of the pain, it is impossible to be mad at Duds. Up here they are 4, all together. Down there he is 1, all alone, and what a strange one he is. God has hurt him and blessed him at the same time. It makes Jonesy giddy just to think of it. "Duditz," he says. "Duditz, it's us. Jonesy." He hands the phone to Henry. "Hi, Duditz, it's Henry." Henry hands the phone to Pete. "Hi, Duds, it's Pete. Stop crying now, it's all right." Pete hands the phone to Beaver, who looks around, then stretches the phone as far toward the corner as the cord will allow. Cupping his hand over the mouthpiece so the old men by the stove, not to mention his own old man, of course, won't hear him, he sings the first 2 lines of the lullaby. Then he falls quiet, listening. After a moment, he flashes the rest of them a thumb and forefinger circle. Then he hands the phone back to Henry. "Duds, Henry again. It was just a dream, Duditz. It wasn't real, okay? It wasn't real, and it's over. Just..." Henry listens. Jonesy takes the opportunity to strip off his flannel shirt. The T-shirt beneath is soaked right through. There are a billion things in the world Jonesy doesn't know. What kind of link he and his friends share with Duditz, for one. But he knows he can't stay here in Goslin's much longer. He feels like he's in the goddamn stove, not just looking at it. Those old farts around the checkerboard must have ice in their bones. Henry is nodding. "That's right. Like a scary movie." He listens, frowning. "No, you didn't. None of us did. We didn't hurt him. We didn't hurt any of them." And just like that, bingo, Jonesy knows they did. They didn't mean to exactly, but they did. They were scared Richie would make good on his threat to get them, and so they got him first. Pete is holding out his hand, and Henry says, "Pete wants to talk to you, Dud." He hands the phone to Pete, and Pete is telling Duditz to just forget it. Be chilly, Willie. They'll come home soon, and they'll all play the game. They'll have fun. They'll have a fucking roll. But in the meantime... Jonesy raises his eyes and sees one of the signs over the phone has changed. The one on the left still says, "Please limit all calls to 5 mins." But the one on the right now says, "Why not go outside? It's cooler." And that's a good idea. Such a good idea. No reason not to, either. The Duditz situation is clearly under control. But before he can make his move, Pete is holding the phone out to him and saying, "He wants to talk to you, Jonesy." For a moment, he almost bolts anyway, thinking to hell with Duditz, to hell with all of them. But these are his friends. Together they all caught the same terrible dream, did something they didn't mean to do. Liar. Fucking liar, you meant it, you did. And their eyes hold him where he is, in spite of the heat, which is now clamped around his chest like a suffocating pad. Their eyes insist that he's a part of this and mustn't leave while Duditz is still on the phone. It's not how you play the game. "It's our dream, and it's not over yet," their eyes insist, Henry's most of all. "It's been going on since the day we found him there behind Tracker Brothers, down on his knees and all but naked. He sees the line, and now we see it too, and although we may perceive it in different ways, part of us will always see the line. We'll see it until the day we die." There's something else in their eyes, too, something that will haunt them all unacknowledged until the day they die,
and cast its shadow over even their happiest days. The fear of what they did. What they did in the unremembered part of their shared dream. That's what keeps him where he is, and makes him take the telephone even though he is sweltering, roasting, fucking melting.
"Duddits," he says, and even his voice sounds hot. "It's really okay. I'm going to let you talk to Henry again. It's super hot in here, and I have to get a breath of fresh..."
Duddits interrupts him, his voice strong and urgent.
"Oh, oh, wow! Oh, ye! Oh, oh, wow! Hey! Hey! Is there hey?"
They have always understood his gabble from the very first, and Jonesy understands it now. "Don't go out. Jonesy, don't go out. Gray. Gray. Mr. Gray." Jonesy's mouth drops open. He looks past the heat-shimmering stove down the aisle where Beaver's hungover father is now making a listless examination of the canned beans, past Mrs. Goslin at the old scrolled cash register, and out the front window. That window is dirty, and it's filled with signs advertising everything from Winston cigarettes and Moosehead ale to church suppers and Fourth of July picnics that happened back when the peanut farmer was still president. But there's still enough glass for him to look through and see the thing that's waiting for him outside. It's the thing that came up behind him while he was trying to hold the bathroom door closed. The thing that has snatched his body. A naked, gray figure standing beside the Sitco pump on its toeless feet, staring at him with its black eyes. And Jonesy thinks, it's not how they really are. It's just the way we see them. As if to emphasize this, Mr. Gray raises one of his hands and brings it down. From the tips of his three fingers, little specks of reddish gold float upward like thistle. Virus, Jonesy thinks. As if it were a magic word in a fairy tale, everything freezes. Goslin's market becomes a still life, then the color drains out of it, and it becomes a sepia-toned photograph. His friends are growing transparent and fading before his eyes. Only two things still seem real: the heavy black receiver of the payphone and the heat, the stifling heat.
"Hey-ah!"
Duddits cries into his ear. Jonesy hears a long, choking intake of breath, which he remembers so well. It is Duddits, readying himself to speak as clearly as he possibly can.
"Onzi! Onzi! Wake up! Wake up! Wake up! Wake up! Jonesy, wake up!"
Jonesy raised his head, and for a moment could see nothing. His hair, heavy and sweat-clotted, hung in his eyes. He brushed it away, hoping for his own bedroom, either the one at Hole in the Wall, or even better, the one back home in Brookline, but no such luck. He was still in the office at Tracker Brothers. He'd fallen asleep at the desk, and had dreamed of how they'd called Duddits all those years ago. That had been real enough, but not the stuporous heat. If anything, old man Goslin had always kept his place cold. He was chintzy that way. The heat had crept into his dream because it was hot in here. Christ, it had to be 100 degrees, maybe 110. Furnace has gone nuts, he thought, and got up. Or maybe the place is on fire. Either way, I have to get out before I roast. Jonesy went around the desk, barely registering the fact that the desk had changed, barely registering the feel of something brushing the top of his head as he hurried toward the door. He was reaching for the knob with one hand and the lock with the other when he remembered Duddits in the dream, telling him not to go out. Mr. Gray was out there waiting. And he was. Right outside the door, waiting in the storehouse of memories to which he now had total access. Jonesy spread his sweaty fingers on the wood of the door. His hair fell over his eyes again, but he barely noticed.
"Mr. Gray," he whispered, "are you out there?" "You are, aren't you?"
No response, but Mr. Gray was all right. He was standing with his hairless rudiment of a head cocked, and his glass-black eyes fixed on the doorknob, waiting for it to turn.
waiting for Jonesy to come bursting out. And then, goodbye annoying human thoughts. Goodbye distracting and disturbing human emotions. Goodbye, Jonesy. Mr. Gray, are you trying to smoke me out? Still no answer. Jonesy didn't need one. Mr. Gray had access to all the controls, didn't he? Including the ones that controlled his temperature. How high had he pushed it? Jonesy didn't know, but he knew it was still going up. The band around his chest was hotter and heavier than ever, and he could hardly breathe. His temples were pounding. The window. What about the window? Feeling a burst of hope, Jonesy turned in that direction, putting his back to the door. The window was dark now, so much for the eternal afternoon in October of 1978, and the driveway, which ran up the side of Tracker Brothers, was buried under shifting drifts of snow. Never, even as a child, had snow looked so inviting to Jonesy. He saw himself bursting through the window like Errol Flynn in some old pirate movie, saw himself charging into the snow and then throwing himself into it, bathing his burning face in its blessed white chill. Yes. And then the feel of Mr. Gray's hands closing around his neck. Those hands had only 3 digits each, but they would be strong. They would choke the life out of him in no time. If he even cracked the window, tried to let in some of the cold night air, Mr. Gray would be in and battening on him like a vampire. Because that part of Jonesy World wasn't safe. That part was conquered territory. Hobson's choice. Fucked either way. Come out. Mr. Gray at last spoke through the door and in Jonesy's own voice. I'll make it quick. You don't want a roast in there, or do you? Jonesy suddenly saw the desk standing in front of the window. The desk that hadn't even been here when he first found himself in this room. Before he'd fallen asleep, it had just been a plain wooden thing, the sort of bottom-of-the-line model you might buy at Office Depot if you were on a budget. At some point, he couldn't remember exactly when, it had gained a phone, just a plain black phone, as utilitarian and undecorative as the desk itself. Now, he saw, the desk was an oak roll top, the twin of the one in his Brookline study, and the phone was a blue trim line, like the one in his office at Jay. He wiped the palmful of piss-warm sweat off his forehead, and as he did it, he saw what he had brushed with the top of his head. It was the dreamcatcher. The dreamcatcher from Hole in the Wall. Holy shit, he whispered. I'm decorating the place. Of course he was. Why not? Didn't even prisoners on death row decorate their cells? And if he could add a desk and a dreamcatcher and a trimline phone in his sleep, then maybe... Jonesy closed his eyes and concentrated. He tried to call up an image of his study in Brookline. For a moment, this gave him trouble, because a question intruded. If his memories were out there, how could he still have them in here? The answer, he realized, was probably simple. His memories were still in his head, where they had always been. The cartons in the storeroom were what Henry might call an externalization, his way of visualizing all the stuff to which Mr. Gray had access. Never mind. Pay attention to what needs doing. The study in Brookline. See the study in Brookline. What are you doing? Mr. Gray demanded. The smarmy self-confidence had left his voice. What the doodly fuck are you doing? Jonesy smiled a little at that. He couldn't help it, but held on to his image. Not just the study, but one wall of the study. There by the door leading into the little half-bath. Yes, there it was, the Honeywell thermostat. And what was he supposed to say? Was there a magic word? Something like Alakazam? Yeah. With his eyes still closed and a trace of a smile still on his sweat-streaming face, Jonesy whispered, "Duddits." He opened his eyes and looked at the dusty, nondescript wall. The thermostat was there. "Stop it!" Mr. Gray shouted,
And even as Jonesy crossed the room, he was amazed by the familiarity of that voice. It was like listening to one of his own infrequent tantrums, the wild disorder of the kids' rooms was a likely flashpoint, on a tape recorder.
You just stop it. This has got to stop.
Kiss my bend, the beautiful, Jonesy replied and grinned. How many times had his kids wished they could say something like that to him when he started quacking? Then a nasty thought occurred to him. He'd probably never see the inside of his Brookline duplex again, but if he did, it would be through eyes which now belonged to Mr. Gray. The cheek the kids kissed, "Ooh, scratchy, Daddy," Misha would say, would now be Mr. Gray's cheek. The lips Carla kissed would likewise be Mr. Gray's. And in bed, when she gripped him and guided him into her, Jonesy shivered, then reached for the thermostat, which he saw was set to 120. The only one in the world that went so high, no doubt. He backed it half a turn to the left, not knowing what to expect, and was delighted to feel an immediate waft of cool air on his cheeks and brow. He turned his face gratefully up to catch the breeze more fully, and saw a heating cooling grate set high in one wall. One more fresh touch.
"How are you doing that?" Mr. Gray shouted through the door. "Why doesn't your body incorporate the virus? How can you be there at all?"
Jonesy burst out laughing. There was simply no way to hold it in.
"Stop that,"
Mr. Gray said, and now his voice